Hello, and welcome to episode 39 of The Crate and Crowbar. It is the 23rd of April. My name is Chris Thurston, and today joining me are Graham Smith.
Hello.
Tom Francis.
Hello.
And the internet's Philippa War.
Hello.
Hi, Pip.
That sounds like a historical event. The internet's Philippa War.
The first Philippa War.
There's a communal ownership as well. Like, I've now got shareholders. Stockholders.
A lot of them, too. You're doing well.
Well, there's no pressure now.
We've all enjoyed a long weekend. 4 days of weekend, which means something to people with jobs. Graham.
I have a job. I totally took that time off, sort of.
What did you do with your exciting bank holiday weekend?
I played Football Manager, which is why I won't be talking that much on this particular podcast, because no one cares about Football Manager except for me. I'm in the year 2020 in my career at the moment, and I started off managing Manchester United, which is relevant to the news at the moment because their real world manager has just been sacked. There's a weird thing in Football Manager when you take over a team where you kind of, their existing manager doesn't get sacked, they just kind of magically become unemployed. And so in...
Isn't that how sacking works?
Well, the game draws a distinction between a person leaving their job, resigning, and being sacked. And so the person doesn't resign or get sacked. They just, so like in my game, basically David Moyes worked in as the Manchester United manager for 7 days and then spent the next 2 years unemployed because this weird person just came in,
so
stole his chair, basically.
Do you feel like maybe what's happened in real life is your fault?
Pretty much, yeah. I think I jinxed him. But in my career, he went and worked for Napoli in Italy for a couple of years and then got sacked from there. Then got a job as the manager of Stoke and got sacked from there. And now he's back as manager of Everton again.
Ooh.
Which, you know, isn't that not a bad outcome for David Moyes? Chris and Tom have no idea what's coming on at the moment.
And a sort of tunnel of bright lights and a glimmering light at the end of it. Tom, what did you get up to?
I shot a bow.
Wow.
Wait, did I get that right? Yes, okay. It's tricky because I think when I was out there, I said that I'd fired a bow before, and they said, no, you don't fire a bow. You only shoot a bow. So this is a taster session for archery, and so I learned, like, what not to say about archery.
Are you going to be in the Hunger Games?
Hopefully not. I'd like to avoid that. I'd like to have the archery skill without actually being in life-threatening danger. And yes, a lot like video games. I was talking to you, Graham, about this, like, back when I first tried it at Christmas with, like, a very shitty, beginner's bow thing, that everything to do with archery is really, really satisfying and cool. So it's actually not at all surprising that suddenly everyone's putting them in video games. Like, they must have just realised, this is a really cool, satisfying thing to do, and it just feels nice, and it's kind of, every interaction has a good sound and has a nice, like, effect to it. And using them in real life is actually... Yeah, quite a lot of games. You know the thing in Team Fortress 2 when you're the sniper with the huntsman and it's when you draw it back, it's kind of accurate for a while, and then if you hold it too long, it starts to tremble?
Mm-hmm.
That's real. Definitely starts to tremble. And the bow I was using at this taster session thing was, I think, 20 pounds draw weight. And that was like, if I held it for more than a few seconds, my arms would start to tremble a little bit. An English longbow, which is what they used in olden times, is 180 pounds draw.
Christ.
And the arrows it fires are 3 foot long and half an inch thick. So I have some idea of what that would be like now. I also got to see, I guess most games that have bows don't have this, but a compound bow, which is the modern type, where it's not that big. An English longbow is huge, like 2-3 meters tall, and this, it looks like a short bow, but the string for it goes up and down like 3 times because it's on a pulley system, like of cams, and it means that it's basically the string has as much tension as if it was 3 times longer, but it's on these cam gears, which means it's still hard to pull back, but once it's back you can hold it there for as long as possible, much more easily because it's kind of locked into place. And so that thing of, like, your aim trembling after holding it back too far for too long doesn't happen because there's less effort involved in maintaining your aim. And then we were firing at these compacted straw targets. I think they're called bluffs or buffs. And they're, like, 4 inches thick or something, and our arrows are just, like, sticking about an inch into them. And then they're quite hard to yank out. They stick in pretty hard. And then a longbow will just about go through it. The tip will poke out the back. And the compound bow, they go almost all the way through it. So it's like stuck into it, and there's like a foot of arrow sticking out the other side. They're fucking amazing.
Did you learn any of the special arrow things, like firing three arrows in a cone, or firing once
throwing so
into
many
the
arrows
air.
Into the air that rain down on your target,
but in a limited area of effect.
No, that must be the next lesson, I think.
Yeah,
bring out like a torch using the water. That would be good.
Yeah, for that they recommend just throwing a water balloon.
Oh. Right.
What about moss?
No moss arrows, as far as I saw.
Holy water.
Mostly, it seemed to be the spikes. Actually, they do have for hunting. They have like. Just a fucking golf ball of metal on the end of the arrow, and it's a concussion thing. You just knock things out with it. Like, the concussive force is what does the damage, not the actual penetration, which is nuts.
Just like a ranged punch.
Yeah. Really, really long range.
Just a boxing glove on the end of it.
Is that because you want your prey to, like, fall over rather than run off limping and, like, freaking out?
Is it maybe because they don't want to break the skin?
But they I guess the risk is it would just go straight through them, and that might do less damage than if the whole... massive weight. They also might just want it to weigh more, so that it's...
Okay.
I guess the point is to get all of the kinetic force to actually hurt the animal, rather than...
More effectively being a dick to an animal.
Yeah. Apparently it's completely illegal to fire a bow at any animal at all in Britain.
Huh.
Because you're stealing the king's livestock. It all belongs to the king.
Good thing.
Is that specifically with a bow?
Yeah. You can shoot them with guns, but not with a bow. Because guns didn't exist when they made that law, so... Come on, that's not covered.
There's like that law that if you run over a deer, you're not allowed... This might be completely wrong, but this is what I believed growing up in the New Forest. If you run over a deer, you're not allowed to take it, like, you know, as if you'd killed it in a hunt. Because that would be, you know, that would incentivize people to drive around trying to run over deer so they can get venison or whatever. But if you come across a deer... that's been hit by a car, you are allowed to take it. And I think, you know, you hear rumours of people driving around in pairs.
Plausible deniability tactics.
Yeah, exactly. That's not relevant to video games.
This also isn't relevant to video games, but there's a what's the word, like a cult of monks? A group of monks.
A cult.
An order.
A monastery.
An order, yeah. A group of monks, who are not allowed to eat anything... they're not allowed to kill any animals, but they're allowed to eat animals if they find them dead. But obviously, most of the time you find an animal dead, it's already rotting and gross and you wouldn't want to eat it. But when there was a new bypass proposed that would go very close to their monastery, they all voted for it because it would create more roadkill that they could then eat morally. Which I think is questionable. I think that's close to killing the animals.
Yeah, maybe they could start up like... a homeopathic vets or something. It doesn't really work.
But it's the kind of thing you would do in a video game if you were assigned the monk role where you're not allowed to kill anything directly. Vote for a bypass.
What game is that?
Ultima Online?
Okay. Pip, how was your long weekend?
It was really good. Yeah.
Played a lot of card games and got drunk, really.
We drank a lot of beer and played a lot of Netrunner, really.
Yeah.
That was about right.
Yeah, it was okay. Didn't play any video games.
Oreo milkshake.
Didn't play any video games. And actually, one of the things I think is interesting is, you know, people take a break from games for a few days, in this case 4 days, and don't really play anything at all, and come back and go, you know, yeah, maybe I can make more space in my life for other things. I came back with sort of the opposite feeling.
Make more space for video games.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been playing less... since I started making games full-time. Which is weird, because, like, technically I have more free time. I'm not trying to do two jobs anymore. But I'm more immersed in the other jobs. So I'm just like... I'm more painfully aware of how much I'm not getting done when I'm doing other things. And also I think making games is the best game. it's like, monstrously complex, incredibly free-form game where you kind of have to make your own objectives, but there's, like, infinite solutions to every puzzle, and the puzzles are really interesting, and... it's difficult to get into, but once you're into it and you can play it, you're like, oh shit, I can do all these really, really, really complex, advanced things. And when I finish doing that, I don't really want to play Supreme Commander against, like, 8 really advanced AIs and have to build an empire from scratch, because that part of my brain has already been worn out for the day.
Mm.
So I want to watch TV.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, I came away from the weekend thinking, that was lovely weather, I wonder if there's any way I could drag my PC into the garden. And, like, because that's the big problem, is I love sitting in the sunshine, but I really want to play video games. And so, like, the glare is the problem, and, like, then you maybe have to build a hood, and that doesn't work either, because then you're just sat in the dark again. So
I was just going to say that there are some audio-only games, but then I realised the one I'm thinking of is called Deep Sea, and to play it, you wear a massive gas mask over your head that completely obscures your vision, but plays sounds of the ocean and that you're in.
Oh, there's and, a couple of, like, audio-only for iPhone as well, but they're all horror, and, yeah. like, and you have to sit there with your eyes closed and you're kind of like freaking out and you're in so I don't know, I really like being outside and in the sunlight. It's just that can't I bring my video games somehow?
What have you been playing, Tom?
I've been playing a game called Make It Good. I hope I'm getting that right. Which is a text adventure recommended to me on Twitter by someone we will hopefully credit in the show notes, because I can't remember the name off the top of my head. I'm not going to tell you why they recommended it to me, because it might be a spoiler. I don't know yet. I haven't got far enough to know. But I said, oh, wouldn't it be cool if there's a game about this? And they said, oh, you should play this. So I'm playing this. You are a alcoholic detective. And so I'm on its side right away. And as the game starts, you're just in your car. You're at the scene of a crime. You arrived at a reported crime. And you just... there's some intro text that just says, like, this is it. If you don't get this case right, you're fired. And there's strong hints that you have not had a great career and that you might be a bit incompetent and also a drunk. And I haven't played a text adventure in ages, so I can't actually remember. I guess I'm never, like, hugely into the scene, so I don't know how much of this game is unusual and how much of it is just the standard way that interactive fiction is done these days. But there's a lot of... it's very interactive. And I think the whole thing just takes place inside this house that you're parked outside when the game starts. And it's just a murder case, and you've just got to solve it, given the evidence around. And there's, like, so far there's only three people I've met, so only three possible suspects. I don't know if that expands later on, but it so far it feels very, very focused and contained, which is good because being interactive fiction, you kind of have a ridiculous number of different things you can do. So even, like, just from your car, you can interact with everything in the glove compartment and the bottle of whiskey in the passenger side and car doors and all this other stuff. But they've got a little better since I last played a text adventure in that if you say, if you're in a car and you say, go to the house, it will put in brackets all the other actions it's had to do in between those two events for you. So, like, oh, opening the door, you mean, and then walking up to the house and then opening the front door and then then you ring on the doorbell.
It also corrects spelling mistakes as well, which I found out.
Yeah, it's I think it's Parchment is the name of the thing I'm running it through, which is just like a web parser thing. So you're just playing it in your browser, basically. And it's even got like a little tip system. But you still do have the problem of not knowing what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do, except by experimentation. So I keep having to just try things. And it says, no, I don't understand what that word is. I don't understand how to do this. And in a way, one of the best things about it is also where that problem is the worst, which is you can talk to people and you can ask them things and you can tell them things. And obviously being a murder investigation, a lot of it is asking people things and finding out their accounts of stuff and, figuring out where they are, conflicting with each other. But I've got to the stage now where, like, the last guy I talked to, gave a slightly different account of what happened when the murder happened. Like, things happened in a different order. And so I wanted to say to him, I've heard it happen in this other order, or just, like, check information. And just trying to do that in any way the game understands is really, really difficult. And I think that it's actually just an interface problem, because I think there's... I looked at the help, and there's actually, like, quite a well-defined system for you either ask something or you tell something. And for asking something, there's a lot of different topics, and a lot of it is the actual challenge is to know what to ask about, to think, oh, there's that black box, let's ask about the black box. You can also have suggested topics. You can say, what can I ask this person about? And they'll give you some basic starting points, which is good, but obviously doesn't go all the way. But for telling people things, there's no guide to what you can tell them, what you can't. So I've discovered all this stuff about the murder, and I want to kind of... What you tell them will change the way they respond to your questions. Like, for example, they might be lying, and I've already had a case where someone was lying, and I was able to prove to them that they were lying, and now obviously they tell me the truth in response to this. Well, they tell me a different lie in response to those questions, which is really cool. But I really wish that when you said, like, tell William, it would just pop up the list of things that I can tell him. Because none of those things would be spoilers. They're all things I am meant to know because I have actually discovered these things through investigation. But without knowing what they are, I keep saying, like, tell him that this person heard a scream at this time. And I'm like, no, it's never going to understand that. And of course it doesn't. But I know that fact is in there somewhere. Mm. And it's, in a way, it sort of adds to some of the kind of the challenge of investigating this thing. Because sometimes you don't know. It accidentally, I think, mimics the feeling of being on, having a hunch about something and having all of the evidence kind of point you away from it and try and stop you from pursuing it, but being determined to do this thing. And the incredibly trivial example, but in the room where the guy is murdered, there's not much in there at all. There's just like a dresser and a bed and the bloodstain in the body and a lamp on the bedside table. And I figured out some like basic clues and got some basic evidence and examined the body, obviously, and looked at their wounds and examined that. And then I really wanted to look under the bed because like that just seemed like, you know, if you're looking searching around for evidence, you should be thorough. And there's a big area of this room that I can't check. But it says it's too dark under there. And then it says, it's too dark under there, and there's probably nothing under there anyway. Or something like that. It's like, it's too dark under there, not that there's anything under there. So it's almost telling you, like, don't bother, just go away. But there's a lamp in the room, so I'm like, okay, switch on the lamp. And then pick up the lamp, and then, okay, you got the lamp, and, like, it's still attached to the wall, so I can only go so far with it. And put lamp on the floor, okay, put lamp on the floor. Look under bed, no, it's still too dark. Put lamp under bed. No, don't know how to do that. shine lamp under bed. I only understood shining the lamp. Use lamp to look under bed. No, don't understand use. Use is too general, so you can't use that. And it really looked like it just, okay, you can't do this. Everything about the game is saying, no, you can't do this. And then eventually I figured out that if I was, at the time I think I was sitting on the bed. So when I was putting the lamp on the floor, I couldn't put it in the right place, and then after I stood up, I found a way to put the lamp on the floor in such a way that it was shining under the bed. I looked under the bed, and it said, hey, it's that button from my coat. I kind of just thought it was a joke at first, and then I went, oh, what? Hang on, what? Why is... What? Because not only is this a button that matches my coat, and I'm missing a button, but, like, my character just knows it's his button. There's not even any doubt about it. And so suddenly that's changed the whole thing, and I don't know... Because I'm a drunk, so I'm, like... evidently have a hazy memory of where I've been and what I've done. And so I don't know anything else about that angle of the story yet, but I think it's hinting down a path where I might actually have some involvement in this case, which is awesome. And I'm hoping that goes further.
It'd be amazing if someone made like a police procedural or a detective show or whatever about like a brilliant detective whose only actual physical presence in a crime scene is like remote control of a Roomba or something, like has to like try and program one of these little like a crap robot to walk around and gather evidence for him. That's basically what sounds like you're simulating, like just that basic lack of kind of input output of the world.
I don't know. I found that because I started playing it on your recommendation, and what I found was that there were things that I really wanted to do in that room, sort of first encountering the corpse, and like, can I just say how judgy is he about their wallpaper? Like, super judgmental.
Well, one of them's a murderer. So.
But anyway, so I got into the room and I was sort of like examine corpse, you know, whatever. But I was doing slightly different things with the lamp. I don't know, I don't really want to spoil it, but, like, I guess, like, if it's quite early on, then... So what I did was I turned on the lamp, sort of trying to work out if there was anything to do with that, and what it does is it illuminates a wooden surface that's had, like, letters scratched into it and stuff like that. And so what I really wanted to do was maybe search the room for a piece of paper so I could do that old trick of, like, you know, rubbing some graphite against the thing.
I also found a piece of paper, so I'm desperate looking for a pencil to do, like,
I've been, like,
a shade over.
Desperately trying to find that.
But, do the shade over. We've seen this on TV. It's the only way to solve the case.
I know. But what happened was, I kept trying to input different commands, but what it does is it sort of, if you have one that the game understands, then what it does is it gives you the snippet of story, but then adds on a sort of a more time-sensitive thing. Like, so what happened was I spent so long trying to find a piece of paper to decode, like, whatever message might or might not be on this wooden surface, that my fellow policeman turned up and was just like, hi, how's the investigation going, drunkie? Yeah. And I was kind of like, I punched him in the face.
I was rummaging under the bed when he came in, so it gives you lots of warning that he's coming and you hear him downstairs, and I just didn't respond, didn't go downstairs, just desperately trying to get this lamp under the bed. Put the lamp under the bed, turn the lamp off, pick it up, put it down again, throw the lamp at the bed, use the lamp on the window. Yes, what do you want?
He's like, yeah, you're not really making yourself look sober in this scenario, are you? Like, whereas I'm just like, trying to do... and then punched him for no good reason. But then after that, because...
I'm glad you can punch him.
Well, it was interesting what you were saying about, you know, tell William whatever else, because I hadn't been doing that. I'd been inputting, like, natural speech. Like, so he'd been... when he came in to talk to me and it was just like... he tackled me to the ground and was like, you won't be punching me in the face anymore, kind of thing. And so, sort of sullen typing, fine. And then it was just like, don't understand. It corrected it to find, and then was like, don't understand the verb in this context.
Yeah, I like it when it corrects it to something that it doesn't understand.
Yeah. And then he was just like, he repeated himself. So I was like, yes.
I tried to...
Like school kid getting into trouble. He understood that though.
When he gets there, he stresses to you that this is like you're on your last legs, and it like if this case blows up, then it's your ass, and he like is having none of it. He says, "Do you understand or something?" So I tried to say "fuck you" to him. Every way I could do it, it had a different problem with it. Like,
tell
I was saying,
"fuck you,"
because I just said "say fuck you," and I said, "Oh, you must mean to the radiator." Well, that's an inanimate object. You're not saying that. No, I think we just what the fuck? It's right in front of me.
Could you flip him the bird?
I didn't try that.
We should try that next.
I liked the though. There's when you arrive at the body, the lady who showed you there leaves, and then you just hear a thump from the next room.
I was trying to find that. It was examine thump.
like
can't do that.
I think that's one area where the limitation of what you can do makes sense. Like there is no kind of the game shouldn't help you to do that. Like there should be no way to look for a thump or to. to like home in on the cause of that, so I just spent ages in that room trying to figure out what in here could have made a thump, and like every heavy object to try moving it and everything that was light trying like dropping it and stuff, like can I make a thump, what did the thump come from, and I found out what it was in the end, but I won't spoil.
Oh, okay, because another thing that sort of kept throwing me off a bit was whenever you move around and it describes the area to you, but it keeps using compass points, and that just kept messing with me because it would describe the area, and I'd sort of like develop a picture of it in my head, but then it would be like, and then to the east, and then I'd be like, but no, okay, so now I've got to reorient what's in my head because that's obviously wrong, and so that kept throwing me off because I didn't see why it should be important. Like, you know, I wanted to be free to imagine the room as long as the basics were correct, unless I guess it makes a difference whether you could see something from a certain angle, maybe. I haven't got far enough to know whether any of that is.
I think it's something to do with obviously it's a text adventure tradition, and I think it's because you could be entering a room from various different angles, and so if there's a door to the east and it describes what's through that door, then when you come back at that room from a different direction, if it had said like the door to the right leads this way, and then next time you come up the room, you're coming from a different direction, then the word right could be ambiguous. So they want to make sure that it's always the same, no matter where you're looking
at it. But it's the way that I, like, when describing something in that way automatically makes me need to have a pen and paper next to me so that I can actually draw it out and start examining it in that way.
I ignore it completely and just treat them as, like, keywords. Like, east is the shortcut to this door, and west is the, like, I never actually figured out whether it makes sense.
Fair enough.
I did try and lie on the bed to look at the mirror and see if I could see the door through the mirror when I'm on the bed in the bedroom. Like, I don't know what the hell I was trying to prove with that.
It is sort of a stroke of genius to have you play, like, a incompetent drunk. Because, like, a sort of marriage of controls and like, premise. Because, you know, like, the whole idea of you stumbling around disorientated, not sure which door is which...
Mm.
You know, not sure even knowing really how to interact with things, or dropping lamps and not really know how to frame sentences in a way that other people understand, only really works to the game's favour if your character is, like, known for this kind of thing.
Did you open the whiskey?
No, I picked it up, and I was going to drink from it, and then I decided to put it back down, which actually was kind of what an alcoholic detective might do in a situation.
Because he's basically got it in the passenger seat, yeah. Hasn't he? So I couldn't get the glove compartment open either.
No, nor could I.
Sorry.
There was a photo frame that I also, it wouldn't let me get open, and I managed to kind of break the game a bit, because it,
like, oh, no.
I tried to break the frame, then it said, oh, you can't break it because there's no glass in it, and the frame itself is too solid. And I'm like, well, there's no glass, just tear the photo then. And I said, okay, torn the photo of the treasure that doesn't exist anymore. And like, okay, so can I get to the thing behind it now? And I just said, like, examine bulge, because that was the thing I was trying to get to. Like I said many times.
It would be nice if the game returned. Still, that's disgusting.
It still treated it as a bulge behind a photograph, even though I destroyed the photograph. And then later on, that photograph became really important. And I kept showing it to people, even though, like, earlier I technically destroyed it and it doesn't exist anymore.
Okay.
It also works really well if you imagine that your character is actually saying everything you type in. Mm-hmm. Like, they're kind of trying to dictate their own actions to themselves. Like, examine bulge! Examine bulge, tell that I didn't tell the photo.
I was wondering, like, how much investigating you kind of need to do for the most part as well, because, like I was saying, like, as long as I typed things that the game thought were intelligible, it kept sort of moving the story along itself. So I'd be interested to know, like, how much investigation you actually need to... I don't know.
Well, so the way you eventually finish the game is you can accuse someone of murdering, and you can also have them arrested. But have them arrested... You have this, like, police assistant guy who's basically does all the official things, any policey things he does for you. So if you need something, like, analysed by the crime lab, you give it to him.
But
if you
want someone arrested... Is he, like, our sidekick?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you need someone arrested, then you've got to get him to do it for you, but he won't do it unless there's enough evidence to actually make a valid arrest. So you can't, like, operate totally outside the law. And so I think it's going to be about, like, piecing together the evidence and then telling him about it and making sure he thinks that the person did it.
Mm. It's kind of cool if you can still progress to the end of the game, even if you're just being incompetent at typing gibberish, but you just don't have any of the information you need in order to either prove that this guy should be arrested or just accuse the right person.
I liked it a lot better than other text adventures that I've played recently. Like, to be fair, I did the worst possible thing, which is I went back to the original Hitchhiker's Guide text adventure and started playing that, like, because obviously it was the anniversary quite recently. Mm. And so this was just so nice that it would at least try and figure out what the hell you were going on about, and it had a slightly better understanding of what you might feasibly be doing at any given point.
I remember that one distinctly, because I think it's the reason I didn't play many text adventures after that, because it was like, go to Bulldozer, it's already here, get in Bulldozer, it's too far away, it's already here, for fuck's sake!
Yeah, I don't think I've ever got out of Arthur Dent's front garden, ever. I've tried.
In Make It Good, the help says that you're unlikely to get a successful conviction on your first playthrough. So it's like, you can accuse anyone, you can obviously, like, presumably it's possible to arrest someone without it being necessarily the right person. So I guess it's possible to get the wrong person, and that maybe fails the game.
Did you get... Have you completed it once?
No.
Okay.
It's cool, though. I somewhat recommend it.
Is it free?
Yeah.
Cool. We'll put a link in the show notes, then. What have you been playing, Pip?
I've been playing Make It Good, obviously. I've also started playing Heroes of the Storm. I nearly called it Heroes of the Swarm.
Heroes of the Half Swarm.
Heroes in a Half Shell. It's fine. I started doing that this afternoon, and it was an interesting experience. It seems to me that it's a lot more... Well, it's obviously a lot less about the individual and their progress, and it's sort of...
This is a Dota-like...
Yeah, sorry, I should probably start at the beginning, like, shouldn't I?
Well, we've talked about it a few times.
We have,
Yeah, so I kind of, like, went into it with my main MOBA having been Dota, or Dota 2, and so I wasn't really sure what to expect. What it ended up being was sort of, it blunts the individual impact that you have, because everyone levels up at the same rate.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's kind of an interesting thing, in that, you know, you sort of, you can't really be a hero, really. You know, well, you know, obviously, but...
Team players of the storm.
So, yeah, and you're sort of, like, working towards a sort of a common goal, but it makes that part of the very bedrock of the game, rather than just like, well, you're kind of working towards a common goal, but one of you might be a lot better than the others and, like, really outshine them and kill steal like crazy Matthew Cox. So, yeah, it was an interesting experience. And also there was a lot more of sort of managing resources, I guess, in terms of, so what you can do is you can go to jungle camps and you kill them to kind of recruit them as mercenaries, and what they'll do is they will
they don't die, they kind of like kneel,
yeah,
when
they're
out.
Sort of like, oh, you're actually quite cool and terrifying.
Now that I'm dead, I
will
the,
do your
virtue,
bidding. Yeah. So then they'll sort of go to the nearest lane and fight on your behalf for, you know, until they get killed, which is quite
please don't kill me, I will now join this doom stream of inevitably dead people.
I hate that video game logic that you have to beat people at their own game for them to work with you. Do you remember the Vice City mission where you had to put together a bank job, and in order to get the getaway driver, you had to beat him in a race? So, if I'm better than you at driving the car, why the fuck am I hiring you to drive the car? You had to prove each individual person was worthless at their task before they joined you.
Yeah, so, but what you're doing is you're essentially putting more bodies in that lane to push it up a bit so that you can perhaps go off and do other, like, individual tasks or things that are sort of specific to that particular map. Like, there's one of them where you can go down into some haunted underground mines. Mm. And so, rather than just taking all of your heroes off the map for a while, because it's a slightly separate area, what you do is you sort of try and get some mercenaries going to sort of hold the fort in the meantime, and then, like, most of you will go down into the mines, and or at least that was my experience. You might have had, you know,
a bit of it as well. Yeah. I mean, we spoke about that last time, though, the mines and how it changed. It's basically,
okay,
the game is much more about, as I think I said at the time, rotations and team fights than Dota, which is something, you know, I kind of want to avoid repeating myself
too much.
But yeah, like, the sorts of things you start doing after 400 hours of Dota are the kinds of things that Heroes encourages you to do from level one. Did you like the hero abilities and stuff? That's what I'd be interested to hear.
Well,
did you enjoy playing as the characters you've played as so far?
Some and some. There were some that obviously benefited from having played Dota, you know, knowing a bit about positioning, like with James Rayner, you know, your first character, you have to
Jim Rayner, I think it's Mom.
Well, yeah.
James.
Well, no, but they call him James in the game. I don't want to disrespect his choices. If he's trying to, like, start off with a more professional kind of, you know,
it's like when Cliffy
B
decided he wanted to be Cliff Bezinski.
Yeah, exactly.
Or The Rock wanted to be Dwayne Johnson.
Yeah.
He had to go through that transitional period where he was Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Yeah.
So, you know,
James Jim Rayner.
I think that could work. But yeah, so there were things like that where you had to do a certain amount of positioning to make sure that you could hit as many bodies with your shot as possible, and as, you know.
Sorry, hit bodies with gun.
Hit bodies with gun. It's
video
what
games.
The video game.
Yeah. Did you play as the siege tank?
No, not yet. I played as the. Her name with the owl that you can send out to
Tyrand.
Scouting. Yeah,
Tyrand.
Mm.
Why don't I even remember these names?
So there's that, and I played as who else did I play as? I played as somebody who can do a sort of melee warrior kind of things.
It is a
like
Warcraft-related
sort of
video game.
Yeah, but, like, there was a slam was one of the
barbarian
abilities. And
was it, like, a dwarf guy or a lady barbarian? A big guy with a sword?
There's only, like, four or five possible wizard characters.
Stitches. I played Stitches. With
the
like, with the pudge hook.
Yeah.
Basically.
Mm.
So, I don't know, it felt like there were a lot of skill shots and stuff to land.
You know,
so it didn't feel entirely skillless. Which is something I was worried about, given that it was kind of like, hey, entry level, you know. I was kind of like, oh, so, you know, maybe it'll just be a kind of click, click, click. Did the other team die faster than you? But obviously, you know, it did feel like there was skill involved, which was really cool. But when I did my first competitive matchmaking thing, I didn't have that horrible sense of complete terror and isolated awfulness that I have had with League of Legends and Dota and, to some extent, Smite, because, you know, it didn't feel terrifying and overwhelming and that there was just too much, you know, because with League of Legends, I just picked Annie, not knowing who she was, what she did. She had a giant teddy bear that looked like it could be fun. And then suddenly it was like, oh, so you're going to have to go mid. And I was like, do I? Is that what this is? You know, is that what this character does? And then, you know, sort of spend the rest of the match, you know, with my team kind of hating me. Mm. So, but that didn't happen with this. And I don't know, you know, maybe I got lucky, maybe it's set up differently, but it didn't feel as confrontational or hostile.
Yeah. I think it benefits at the moment partly from the fact that it's a quite a closed technical alpha.
Yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't have hordes of people in it that are likely to be dicks to you. I wonder if that kind of orthodoxy will kind of emerge, you know what I mean? Like this kind of, the meta game that says this, you know, you pick this guy, you have to do this, or you've done it wrong, like, you know, that's
there
what
there's a certain amount in, like, global chat, you know, just people sort of saying, oh god, I was on a team, didn't even have any support, you know, it's that kind of...
Yeah, it's interesting, like, I find myself going through this cycle of, like, oh man, this seems completely broken. Like, actually, last time I spoke about it on the podcast, maybe to update on something, I spoke about how the invisible heroes felt completely broken because they're permanently invisible. And there's no standard counter to invisibility in the game, like there is in Dota where you can buy a particular item or something. Mm. And then I ended up talking to the game's, like, lead designer, which is the best way to resolve these issues. You have an opportunity to...
Fuck you, man!
Yeah. I was like, you know, okay, this is going to sound a bit specific, but what the fuck is the counter to Zeratul? And he's like, Zeratul's a bit overpowered at the moment. I was like, thank you! But he said specifically, though, the invisibility wasn't. And, you know, he said that, well, in this game, if someone ever takes damage of any kind, it breaks invisibility. And so I was like, because a lot of the supports, as you level up, you can pick new passive traits and things. And a lot of the quote-unquote support heroes and the melee heroes have one that basically means that you do permanent damage in a little area around you. It's basically a free radiance, if you play Dota. And I'd always seen that as this kind of, like, greedy pickup, like a Radiance is in Dota, where you pick up this item that does AoE around, like, AoE damage around you just to buff your damage a bit, really, to try and, you know, mop up more kills. Then I noticed, hang on, that's actually a really good defensive item for supports against melee ranged invisible heroes, because it basically surrounds you in this sort of damaging halo that means as long as you can stay in range of someone, they can't go invisible. So you just follow them, basically, like, poking them in the back, going, hey, hey, I know where you are, hey, 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 until someone comes and helps you. Like you probably shouldn't do in a supermarket or something if you're lost, and and that was good. I do sort of agree though that it always feels a bit gold stars for everybody. You know what I mean? Like there's something of the like heroes of everybody gets a sticker at the end.
Political correctness gone mad. Like somewhere there is a, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the
Tory newspaper really angrily writing an op-ed about this game right now.
Yeah, they're bloody millennial heroes that get everything for free. Like, yeah, that, it depends on which side of the pond you're on, I guess, which tiresome op-ed, what source that tiresome op-ed would come from. But yeah, I guess, I mean, like, it is that, you know, when I was new, we had to be shouted at by 12-year-olds for 18 hours a day. Just to have 1 gram of fun.
Something that I do, yeah, that I do worry about is that I won't necessarily have a massively strong attachment to it because where there's no chance to fail utterly or like fail so badly that the rest of your team is a million like levels ahead of you in the way that Dota can sometimes. You're just like, I'm level 3, that's going to come back to bite me when everyone finishes this one. But like, it also means that there's no chance to super excel, you know, like the sort of the highs and lows are sort of leveled out. And I think maybe that just over time would have less and less of an impact.
You feel less crushing relief when someone on your team shows clemency.
It feels like this is a game that facilitates more healthy relationships between you and your friends.
I don't know if that is
maybe
healthy.
I've got a properly messed up world vision, having just come from such a brutal, kind of unforgiving, insult laden.
I don't know. I think for me, like the thing that
and
made,
that's just from Chris.
The thing that made Dota not just a game that I played, but something I take quite seriously and want to play all of the time and think about all the time was the interpersonal relationships that it fostered with other people, the fact that I could let people down, but I could also succeed to an extent that they would be pleased. You know what I mean? And having to find good ways of, moderating my own behavior and in ways that are not always successful, but you know, the effort is still there. Like the other day during a team practice session, we had basically a full on argument by our standards. Not nasty, but like a disagreement was had about something that had happened in a team fight. And, you know, sides form and, you know, assumptions are questioned and people start to try and break down like why people think what they do about a particular situation in the game and what it says about the play in general. And I think because the game has the capacity to divide people like that, that has an equal and opposite effect, where it actually has a capacity to foster understanding of one another and expectations about how each of us are going to react in particular situations and try and temper that. Because in this situation, it was where myself and the guy who plays mid on our team, Matt, are both known for being probably too aggressive most of the time. And we were both convinced that for once, this wasn't like a boy who cried wolf situation. Being too aggressive was actually the solution to the problem. And so actually trying to explain that to someone else was about unpicking, like, well, I know you know this about me, but ignore that for a minute. I'm actually right this time. And I don't think Heroes of the Storm yet has shown that it has the capacity to foster that kind of argument. that kind of understanding between people, right? Like,
well, I guess the physical distance as well is smaller, as in, because the maps are smaller, so there's less of a chance of you being completely and utterly in the wrong place as well.
It's much more substantially gated as well.
In Dota, you can be on the other side of the map, pootling around, suddenly realise you should have been on the other side about 5 minutes ago. You've got no way to get over there. Everyone's dead and it's kind of your fault.
Yeah.
Whereas this is kind of like, oh, everyone's over there. Okay, I'll just, you know, wander over and it'll be fine.
I'll get on my horse.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to maybe getting my rainbow unicorn.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Diablo riding a rainbow unicorn is a joke that takes a surprisingly long time to get old. Also, actually, and also in the game's favour, I think the more imaginative abilities and skills and heroes and stuff do start to kind of occur as you play more of it. Like, the siege tank's ultimate is it just fires like a huge fucking bullet, one of those Mario bullets. Like, it's bigger than the tank, and it fires it in just a straight line, and it goes, I think, forever in a straight line across the entire map. So it's a sort of global skill shot. It's quite slow moving, so it's very hard to hit a moving target very far away. But one of the upgrades you can pick for it means that when it reaches the edge of the map, it wraps around to the side of the map like an asteroid or Pac-Man or something. And so at which point it will travel the map forever until it hits something. Like in this kind of, and I think it might accelerate over time. And obviously there's a chance that it will hit a mercenary cab or a creep or something like that before it hits a player. But hypothetically, it's possible to create this sort of like globally orbiting like death missile that like goes past like a train every couple of minutes, like, oh, guys, just step back, there goes the missile. And then stuff like that I really love about these games. Like, that's kind
is
of
is it wrapping because it's been once around the planet?
Yeah, that's it. It's something like orbital, it's like orbital ordnance or something. It's called, like, you just, you know, it just keeps going forever. But yeah, like stuff like that I think is a reason to
humour as well. Like, I mean, it's particularly pronounced in the tutorials as well, because like you're sort of titting about as Jim Rayner, and he's just like, I think he says something to Uther, and Uther's like, I've already done my tutorial. This is your, you know, you have to do yours. We'll have to do our title. And it was just kind of like those sort of slightly fourth wall breaky kind of, oh, we're in a computer game and we all know it kind of moments, which is, I just, yeah, it genuinely brought a smile to my face in a way that quite a lot of other games don't in that way. I mean, you know, there's a lot of like smart and snappy dialogue that you'll find in something like Dota, or like, you know, there's a lot of puns in Smite and stuff like that, but they don't quite raise a smile in the same way that Blizzard stuff tends to, I think.
Blizzard are at their best when they're funny, I think.
Yeah, well, like, it kind of felt like some of their April Fool's texts, you know, like, there's just them having an actually joyful experience in creating the game.
Yeah, they're aware
which
of,
I really like.
Like, when they have an opportunity to make fun of themselves, they sort of, it loses a lot of that kind of really heavy, baggy lore that drapes itself over a lot of those franchises.
Heavy bag lore.
Baggy lore.
A lot of Blizzard baggy lore.
That sounds like it could be a Blizzard character.
Heroes of baggy lore.
Blizzard baggy lore. A dwarf.
Yeah, I mean, actually, one of the things that was interesting talking to Dustin Browder, who I think is the designer, maybe the producer, informally of the StarCraft series, formerly of Red Alert, actually. I think it was one of the designers of Red Alert 2. was that he was quite adamant that people, one of the things that's sort of extraordinary about that genre is that it stayed the so much the same for so long that, you know, his argument is that basically the lane pushing format is essentially the FPS, but what we're living in is the world where no one made anything but Doom for, like, you know, 8 or 9 years. Like, there was no Deus Ex, there was no Hexen or Thief or any other attempt to diversify on the formula. And so his argument is like, well, it doesn't really ultimately compare. It's this, it's something else. And I think that argument is valid and an interesting one. At the same time, I also think that the comparison is sort of immediate and obvious and will be, you know, relevant to a huge number of people. Like Ars Technica did that interesting study of Steam accounts where they sort of trawled for data to find out really what the usage statistics are. And, you know, the most played game on Steam is Dota 2 with 26 million active players, which is 26 million players total, I think, or something like that. I can't remember the exact, you know, parameter on that data, but...
Like registered accounts or something, maybe?
People who've played it.
Okay. I think
it was,
and that's like half of Steam accounts, right?
I mean, yeah, and that's kind of nuts, right? Yeah. Like, it means that whenever you discuss any game in this genre, you can't kind of not assume some familiarity with, or even, you know... Yeah, and then, you know, Valve just sold out a 10,000-seater arena in 4 minutes for people wanting to go to Seattle to watch other people play Dota. And it's like, Heroes of the Storm will have to compete with the fact that a surprisingly large number of people like the hard version. Which isn't, I mean, that's going to sound fanboyish, but it's like the old notions of accessibility are breaking everywhere. Like Roguelike being really, really popular again, DayZ being super popular, you know, even Garry's Mod or, you know, other creative games which are complicated by their nature. And I think the notion that you make an easier game to make a more popular game is totally dead.
But I didn't get that impression from this. I didn't get the feeling that it was like, we'll just do the easy version. It did feel like its own thing, or at least sort of so far it kind of does.
Mm.
Or I'll be interested to see if it carries on feeling like that, or whether it's just because it is so unlike.
I think that's fair, actually. And something that'd be interesting... Sorry, go on,
Tom. In terms of the, like, whether... I'm interested by this question of, like, are we in the Doom clone phase where anything that's remotely like Doom is called a Doom clone instead of a first-person shooter because it's not a genre yet? And it feels like actually we, I guess not that quickly after the conception of Dota 1, but certainly by this point we've had loads and loads of different takes on MOBAs or whatever you want to call them. But a lot of them have just not really taken off. Like things like, what was the gas-powered one?
Demigod.
Was a take on that was pretty different. And the number of, like, free-to-play games that have a Dota-type template, but then do something really different with it, is huge. But most of them, I mean, a lot of them are kind of quietly successful, but pretty much you only really hear about Dota and LoL and maybe Heroes of the Storm when it comes out.
Mm.
So it's interesting that, like, I think it's true that at this point of the FPS evolution, we didn't have that much variety. It kind of took a while for people to start deviating from shotgun, machine gun, rocket launcher, explosive barrel, imp. And in fact, like, I mean, even Heretic was basically just reskinned. A lot of the actual effects of those weapons were the same as the Doom weapons, but in different ways. But yeah, it's interesting. I think probably we're in a, like, gaming is just big enough now that when something does take off, the number of different versions of it you get is larger in any given space of time. Like, it gets more attempts to capitalize on it than it did at the time of Doom.
What I really like is the... So in the tutorial section, it's kind of like Rainer's like, oh, well, you know, why are we trying to destroy this thing over here? And it's like, don't overthink this. Let's not go into that. But what I really like is the terminology as well, like what people will come up with to describe these obviously performing the same function, but like having to be their own thing. So in Smite, you're trying to destroy a titan, and it is protected by phoenixes, which, you know, makes sense, because the phoenixes respawn after a given time, and they sort of perform the same function as, I think it's like the suppressor in League of Legends, because it means that you have super strong creeps for a while.
What is Smite?
Oh, Smite. So Smite is another MOBA, but it's based around ancient gods, or current religion gods as well, for some... points.
Gods, ancient and modern.
Yes. Gods, no, no. But yeah, so what the main difference for that is, it gives you a third person kind of over the shoulder perspective. And so it's kind of like, for me, it was like playing Dota, but you're down on the board. You're sort of having to like look around properly. And, you know, if someone's creeping up behind you, you can't just look, you know, get your top down map view and sort of see it happening. You have to actually be physically turning and sort of like 180 degrees going, shit, someone's snuck up behind me. Am I about to die? So it's actually really good fun. But yeah, in that they have, you know, the phoenixes as, you know, instead of these suppressors, and you're trying to defeat the enemy Titan. In Dota, obviously, you're trying to, like, just smack up an ancient, and, like, you know, there's smack towers on the way.
Smack my ancient up with some tag.
It's basically just a really big rock garden.
Yeah, essentially. It's a you know, it's a garden feature. Lovely.
One of them's also kind of a volcano.
Yeah. It's fine. Well, you... how would you know if it was an evil rock garden?
Actually, they're not good or evil.
Oh, what?
What? Actually, I think you'll find.
I think you'll find that baggy lore is not to be taken lightly.
This is like what I was saying to you the other day, though. How, so there was a movie ages and ages ago, I think, and two people who were the stars of it both insisted that they deserved top billing. And to resolve that, the studio put one of them on the poster in the top right and the other one in the bottom left. So you would encounter one of them first if you reading left to right, and one of them first if you were going top to bottom.
Is the movie Towering Inferno?
Quite possibly.
Where Steve McQueen and Paul Williams, famous car guy. He does the voice of the old car in Cars. He's one of the most famous actors.
Come on! You don't remember that one, you know.
I can't remember now, but he's one of the world's most famous actors, and he died a few years ago. But yeah, that's
Paul Newman?
Paul Newman, that's it.
Yes.
Paul Newman and Steve McQueen. That was what it was invented for. And it still gets used a lot in movie posters today.
They also do the thing where, like, the person who's... They have like a lineup of like five people, and the names are wrong for every single one of them, because the person in the middle is prime billing, and so they have to be on the left in the names, and then the person in the middle in the names has to be on the left in the poster.
But yeah, the reason I mentioned that was that I thought maybe that was why the Radiant and the Dire are in, sort of, you know, the
bottom left and top right.
Yeah,
because neither one's better.
One is better if you like going from the left.
Well, I think there's actually a statistic where you are marginally more likely to win if you're on the Radiant side. But I wondered whether that would be affected by if the Radiant were top left and the Dire were bottom right, like whether that would be a sort of an interesting psychological...
It weirds me out in Heroes of the Storm that the bases are on a horizontal plane. But they're not diagonal to one another, they are left and right.
Eliminating that imbalance.
Yeah, and I think, it's the old fighting game thing of having to learn how to do your character backwards, because fighting right to left is really weird compared to fighting left to right. Like, such a strange sort of human brain thing. But yeah.
It's quite weird in
I find it hard to scroll from right to left.
In a single player RTS, it's rare for you to start at the top of a map and have to work your way down. You almost always start at the bottom of a map, and then like it seems natural to work your way up somehow.
Yeah, and up and right.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And I mean, and, you know.
Up and right is the natural direction of progress for all of mankind.
Well, the thing is, in the tutorials, they seem to acknowledge that, in that you start on the left hand side and you're working out to the right. So it was actually a slight sort of, you know, mental readjustment when I got dropped into a match and it started on the right. I was like, oh, I didn't even know this was a thing that could happen. This is weird.
Do we still have games like Doom? Because they're like talking about how a genre evolves. When there's one thing that starts a genre, and for a while the thing just copies it, and then they start to branch out, and it becomes seen as a genre, and we realise that not everything is just copying Doom. There's a legitimate kind of area here to be explored and different avenues. And it feels like the thing that became the mainstream of that is Call of Duty and realistic shooters, and kind of I guess Halo as well. But neither of those are actually that much like Doom in terms of... Doom was a kind of fun and very fast and very, like, volatile, like, brutal shooter where everything dies in just a few hits, or there's explosive barrels that kill them in one hit, and the weapons are completely over the top and nuts. And I guess we have, like, the painkiller games kind of feel a bit like that. Serious Sam, yeah. Which
New Wolfenstein's got quite a bit of that to it from the couple of times I played it. Like, I'm quite looking forward to that game, actually. It's out fairly soon, I think, and I've had fun with it every time I played it. But that game still has Modern Warfare-style scripted bits and cutscenes and the rest of it. It's just the thing between those cutscenes is this sort of ultra-violent, very fast... although you can play it as a stealth game, but, like, mostly an ultra-violent, very fast game about holding two enormous guns and, like...
Do you remember ever finding a Doom enemy who hadn't seen you yet? You couldn't really play as a stealth game, but if you ever found one, like, because it was so rare... They didn't even have a standing pose, so they would have to run on the spot. They were just, like, running on the spot.
Oh, boy, I'm ready to go. Can't wait to see him. Oh, boy. Oh, boy, I've trained all my imp life for this.
It only happens, like, once.
There have been a couple of remakes of older games, like older 3D Realm stuff. Was it Rise of the Triad? What was the other
Shadow Warrior?
Shadow Warrior, yeah. And one of them, I can't remember which one, I get them mixed up.
People seem to quite like Shadow Warrior.
Shadow Warrior is beautiful to look at. I didn't actually enjoy it. I played it for a little while, and I didn't really get anywhere with it. I remember playing Shadow Warrior at the time, and it was... Again, I feel like one of the sort of characteristics of games back then was that you just killed things really fast, and I guess they were kind of easy for a while, but then, like, when things did get hard, it was completely impossible, because everything just died in very few hits, and everything was very kind of... I remember that being the big difference between those games and Quake, and I think maybe more games ended up taking after Quake, where everything takes a lot of hits, and it's kind of a battle of attrition, and you've just got to pour the nails into stuff.
Yeah.
Do you think we've sort of come full circle, then, in terms of, so you have Doom, then you have Doom clones, then you have a period where people have made enough things that fit into that general thought space and action space that you come to a collective understanding of what a genre is that has emerged from that, and then we've sort of taken it and run with it for so long that there is now a place again for Doom clone because it means something within that genre still. Specifically,
yeah, I think it does. I think it's become a much more meaningful thing. If you make a Doom-like game now, it's noteworthy and interesting. I also think it's really cool. I think Doom is very good. Maybe not that controversial an opinion.
Piano.
No.
It's amazing. Like,
oh, is that the thing Soz did?
George Buckingham. They had it at
Eurogamer.
Yeah. Shush now. And so what it is they wired up all the keys, the piano keys, to different types of input. So there was a section of white keys on the keyboard that were strafe left and a section that were, you know, turn right, and there was one that was fire. And I remember sort of sat there perched on a stool with Paul Dean, like, you know, just desperately trying to, like, play our way out of trouble through the level and stuff. That was pretty awesome. You should definitely give that a go if you can. I don't know where it is at the moment. Like, it might be travelling.
I think something about the FPS that maybe helps to explain the arc a bit is the fact, and definitely explains why it's different to Dota-likes, is the FPS, in addition to being games, also kind of carried the burden of games and games technology. Like, the idea of games approaching simulation or approaching realistic depictions of real life, that was always going to involve the first person, because that is the nature of any realistic depiction of real life. And it was also going to involve increased interaction with a world that you experience in the first person, and all the pioneering games doing that were shooters, basically, in terms of reaching into the frame. Like, the immersive sim comes from people trying to add new interactions to the shooter, really, but none of them really lost shooting, you know? They became spy games or thief games or whatever. And when you see that as the aim of the genre, partly, not just to make cool shooters, but to make more realistic depictions of real life, then the arc into Modern Warfare and stuff makes a lot more sense. Like, you know, you start to see that, okay, well, this is the most spectacular roller coaster we can put you on, using this technology. Whereas Dota likes are, I think, the most video game of all video games. Like, they are pure video game. They are,
yeah, they're son of video game.
They are part of video game's own baggy lore about itself. Like, because you play, like, simple iconic characters in a very abstract map where, you know, the rules of real life physics and things don't really have to make sense. People understand they don't make sense, and they're trying to make fun of you for trying to explain it. Like, why does this rhinoceros guy know how to reverse the properties of matter? Shut the fuck up.
It feels like MOBAs don't condense in the way that first-person shooters would do. Like, first-person shooters are fundamentally defined by first-person camera and shooting of things, and so it's much easier to clone them and maintain that, whereas with MOBA-likes, it's like, it feels like there are seven different things that are intrinsic to the genre in a way that, so we, like, End of Nations never actually came out in the end, it just limped along until it was cancelled. But at one point it had a mobile-like mode, and there were lanes that you were pushing your way through and capture points and like creeps that were tanks that you didn't control. But they didn't feel anything like a MOBA because it didn't have heroes, you weren't an individual character, you were like six different groups, you were constantly calling in new units like Ground Control and stuff like that. It feels like maybe...
It's like, it's an idea, not a genre. Like, there's no one game you can really point to and say...
But I like that the more games come out and the more games try and riff on it, the better that helps a community define what it means by MOBA or by lane pushing it. So when you've got something like Smite turn up, that means that you sort of need to decide whether top-down or whether third-person is intrinsic to a thing.
I mean, I don't really think that's evidentially the case, though. Like, I don't think we're at a point of approaching agreement on this.
No, but the more games that come up and that try and do odd or weird twists with it, simply, you know, maybe because they're copying a winning formula but need to make it legally distinct even. But, you know, you can sort of get a feel for what something is by the things that do and don't work or the things that are accepted. As,
team,
you know, you find the
team-based multilateral tug of war.
I kind of miss those early days of before the FPS genre became established. People hadn't really figured out that it probably shouldn't be fantasy yet, and so there's Heretic, Hexen, Hexen 2. Did anyone play Witch Hunter? I think it was called.
No,
another first-person melee thing back in the sprite era. So it was sort of those 2.5D engines where, you know, like Build and like Doom, where the environment is kind of made of polygons, but the enemies are all sprites, and your basic weapon was just a giant two-handed sword, and you would cut people. I think it had that thing where, like, you cut someone down in that diagonal line across the shoulder that's very popular, and they kind of, like, fall into two pieces. That was a big part of it. And it really, like, I remember it feeling just very different, because I played Heretic at that point, I think, and that was, felt very different to Doom and stuff, but it's still a big, colourful, sparkly... Woo world. And then Witch Hunter was like much grimmer and much kind of greyer and still deeply silly, but all those games had a really nice kind of feel of everything being more fragile and everything being much easier to kind of blow up and cut up and set fire to, and they felt very like volatile and tactile.
Something I'm quite looking forward to about Wolfenstein, which is not everyone's going to like about it, is the fact that for as dumb as it is, it takes itself as absolutely seriously as those games kind of used to. Like, I think the thing you forget, like, Doom obviously looks silly, and not silly, but, like, it's cartoonish in sort of garish, like, 90s comics were, like, it's very much...
Pink monsters.
Yeah, it's very much from that era. But it wasn't a joke, you know what I mean? It wasn't ironic. It was just, this is what this is. We're making a big mutant blow-up game for grown-ups. And I don't know whether it's deliberate with New Wolfenstein, but it is so deadly serious. Like, it is, you know, I mean, you know, Call of Duty, modern Call of Duty is the most irony-free of games, more or less, in terms of, you know, just, you know, deadpan. Or like the new Medal of Honors or something, where it's like, you know, made in consultation with real soldiers. It's really like war. Now make sure you shoot snipers in the right order or they'll blow up five helicopters. but the new Wolfenstein is like, you know, yeah, trying to save these brave Allied soldiers from these patrolling Nazi robo dogs is a real statement on man's inhumanity to man.
Robo dogs inhumanity.
Yeah, exactly. And man's inhumanity to robo dog. Like, you know, oh god, these.
You can totally get a robo dog in Heroes of the Storm as well. Yeah.
You can ride around on a robo dog. That's
the
true.
Threads.
Yeah, and I really love that about it. Like, I played the first 3 hours of the game and the later sequence as well, and I find that completely delightful. I almost want all shooters now to be completely so committed to being as stupid as possible, but without ever winking at the camera. Like, I want, like, no more, like, we're going to reboot Duke Nukem, and it'll be a total disaster because we'll both get and unget the joke simultaneously, and like, it's sort of like quantum entangled, awful thing. I want BJ Blazkowicz, like, mournfully chainsawing an empty and thinking, like, how did we come to this?
I find something quite pole-faced about the new Wolfenstein, though. Like, I feel like it's getting in the way of its own fun. Like, if the original Doom was, you know, made by a bunch of teenagers who used to draw pentagrams in the front of their mask book, this feels way more considered, you know, the stretch of 20 years. Like, with the kind of red logo aesthetic and the Bob Dylan music and the weird environment puzzles that they got in between, it just feels like
it's the same thing. It is like, it's a weird, you made an analogy, because I think it's sort of the same thing in a PC game preview, where it's like, it is the kid that's sitting in a, like, a history lesson, and they're half listening to World War II military history, but they're staring out the window and thinking about, like, a Steven Seagal movie they watched. and that is the information that's being processed. It's, yeah, like, you know, oh no, when the Allies were struggling to make a beach landing, they could totally jump from one plane to the other in midair and then crash the other plane into the giant stompy Nazi robot like that. You know, because it is so difficult for the game to try and make an important statement about anything, really, when it's a game about a man, like, like an 8-foot-tall Mega Man running down a corridor with a shotgun in each hand, shooting future Nazis who are all still German, even though they've taken over the world and this level is in London. Because it's so difficult for the game to even approach serious meaning at that point, I find it kind of delightful that it's trying. This is tilting at windmills thing that I find really charming.
I guess I don't mind the cutscenes so much as just, it's the laser cutting tool which you use to, like, cut holes in wire fences in order to progress, and the kind of, it feels like I want them to rip out all of the Half-Life 2 elements from it, basically, and embrace more of the Doom, Quake, Wolfenstein thing, even if they're comparing it with Call of Duty style super serious cutscenes and poignancy.
Yeah,
there's a degree. Do you know what happened? So with the Call of Duty, like, super serious kind of, the terror of war and, you know,
Authenticity.
How they have all the cutscene quotes and things, or like, if you die, you have the quotes. I found that what helps you take them far less seriously is imagining them as, like, the Call of Duty equivalent of Jenny from the Block. Like, you know, just asserting their authenticity and, you know, just at every given time.
They remember where they came from.
Yeah, exactly. In, like, a pink velour tracksuit while Ben Affleck, like, rubs sun cream into their butt on a
boat.
Don't
be fooled by the rubber Nazi dance that I got. I'm still a shooter from the wall.
I do really like that Titanfall still has those quotes, but they're from fictional readers. It's all about future war. So it still has those same sort of, you know, ruminating on the troubles of war.
I fucking hated those. They really pissed me off. It's like, oh, that would have helped, would it? That fucking little pearl of wisdom. That would have stopped me getting shot by the dude who could shoot through cup.
And this is the thing, though, like, because we invent, like, different forms of, like, conflict, because games are, you can do whatever you like. So if you want space robots or robot Nazis or space Nazis, whatever, you can. But you still, like, try and hang off these little, like, you know, inspirational poster style pearls of wisdom off them, where it is a man going, like, a lot of people have died in this war, a lot of good people, was it worth it? Robot drops out of space. The answer is yes. Like, you've answered your own question by summoning the awesome robot.
Do you know what, I'd really like a mod that would just let me replace the meaningful war quotes with poignant things that people have put on their Tumblr, you know, like, just a random selection, or like live journal comments, or, you know, like terrible deviant art, like, you know,
Pornhub comments.
Christ. I actually want the opposite. I want the mod that allows, like, you know, games have, like, chat wheels, whatever, you set from as preset phrases rather than useful things like go for the enemy flag or retreat. I want just, like, a series of pithy military history quotes, like, on a dial that you
That's
can...
not what you want, though. You want song lyrics.
No, I genuinely want, like, focus on one enemy until he is destroyed.
Maybe
then you
I
have completed battle,
lyrics.
Sun Tzu. Like,
see, I just, yeah, I think I want song lyrics. Yeah. I'd just be happy if it let me quote the village people at people. Be fine.
How did we get on this from Heroes of the Storm?
We're talking about, like, it inventing a genre, well, Dota inventing a genre, and whether that, how that relates to Doom inventing a genre.
thing I was trying to say before.
Sorry.
No, I didn't express it well at all, and I still don't think it makes any sense. But
I gotta say,
keep on trucking, Graham.
I'm not sure. It's the thing of, like, it feels like Doom created a genre in a way that it doesn't feel like Dota created a genre. It feels like Dota took all of these existing elements much more and pieced them together in a way that... So if you have, like, Doom or first-person shooters are an umbrella term for a category which can then specialize in a number of different areas, it feels like Dota, if you specialize it in a number of different areas, it becomes its kind of source material. If you specialize it to just be about RPG heroes fighting on a board, then suddenly you've made Diablo back. If you focus on the creeps or that kind of resource management and that sort of stuff, oh shit, now it's a real-time strategy game. It feels like it is
yeah.
son of video games in a way that it's already at the sharp end of the point where you can't, you know, you can take rock music and it forks off into prog rock and all this glam rock and so forth, but you can't necessarily do that when you get down to what's already a very particular niche sharp end of
the
point.
That would explain why
it is
the stuff that's done really well.
That's why the baggy lore. That's why there's so much lore. It's like the yes of video games.
The two Dota likes that have done really well are LOL and Dota 2, and they're both pretty similar to Dota, and like they don't fundamentally change the formula.
Dota 2 just seems like it is Dota.
Dota 2 is Dota. I mean, it shares the same designer who does parity patches to make sure they are exactly the same. So, yeah, like
does he patch Dota 1?
Ice Frog. Ice Frog is an Valve employee, but they obviously just let him do Dota 1.
I didn't know he still did it.
So, and Dota 1, like, it's not quite parity yet. There's some heroes that are in Dota 1 that aren't in Dota 2, and there's some Warcraft 3 engine things that mean that some of the things that they want to change and that they've fixed in Dota 2 can't be fixed in Dota 1. Like, they can't stop jungle creeps going to sleep at night. That is like hard.
You try to wake them up and they just won't move.
That is like hard coded into the Warcraft 3 engine to the extent that it's a different game mechanic. So, you know, jungle creeps won't aggro you if you walk past them at night in Dota 1, but they do in Dota 2.
That's great.
There's an amazing video, Dota 1 video, really famous one where there's a character called Ogre Magi. And in Dota 1, because obviously they were reusing so many assets and recoloring Warcraft 3 assets to make all these 100 plus heroes, they just full on used an asset that's also used for jungle creep. Like, he's exactly the same as a jungle creep. It's also true of, there's a hero in Dota 1 who looks exactly like one of the default melee minions for one of the Lifestealer is a dire minion in Dota 1. There's a great gank where this guy has gone into the jungle at night, killed the guy he looks exactly like, and then he's just standing there pretending to be in a sleep neutral creep. And then so this guy comes back to pick up some easy gold on the way back to lane or something and gets completely annihilated by his player, like, I'm asleep. So stuff like that doesn't exist anymore. But other than that, no, there's parity between the two. Something I was going to suggest back on Heroes of the Storm, talking about Blizzard sort of simplifying the formula, is the comparison a lot of people have made, and I've made it, is Hearthstone. And, the Heroes is to Dota what Hearthstone is to Magic the Gathering and all the rest of it. And in the last week, I have sort of finally decided that I'm done with Hearthstone. Like, I feel like I've finished it. Not because I'm the greatest player in the world, not because I've maxed out the rankings,
<you are. laughs>
or that I've collected all the cards, but because it's a competitive game where I will reliably have exactly the same game over and over again, because the metagame has stabilized to the point where it feels more or less inert. And obviously, that's, very true of, I mean, you hear the same at the competitive level. And I said something like this on Twitter, and I got a lot of people agreeing with me, which suggests that maybe I'm not
the
person.
It was borne out by that interview that I did with the guy who plays at such a super high level, and he was just like, it's not interesting at this point. It needs a lot of, a big card injection or, like, something to really shake it up.
Have Blizzard said whether they will? Because that's the thing.
They've announced
the Magic the Gathering is that there's constantly new cards floating out.
Yeah, but my concern with Hearthstone was partly that I think, I was like, well, they simplified the formula in this way that makes it really super fun and accessible, and you have this amazing honeymoon period with it, which can last quite a long time. But if beyond a certain point it stabilizes, then I don't think it... Well, I think Hearthstone will retain people because it's massive now. But it won't retain me, whereas, like, I think, it's been 3 months since the last big Dota patch, and Dota patch day is the most exciting day. It's the best day. But, like, and then people are starting to get antsy for a new patch now, but it's not like the game feels stagnant. People may have sussed out the meta, but it still feels like there's so much complexity there that someone's going to discover something weird tomorrow, and that's going to shoot up and be, shoot up the meta, and pro teams will be doing it, and that'll be interesting. Whereas, I wonder if you know, Blizzard's sort of like reduce, refine, kind of perfect formula might actually act to heroes' detriment as well in the long run. If, you know, if the meta game stabilizes to the extent that, I think for me, the death of a competitive game is when you can have the same match twice.
I think that's what I was worried about in terms of not having the emotional highs and lows. You know, you kind of can't feel massively culpable, but you also can't feel like you've made a huge difference for your own sake and as an individual. And so I think that given that sort of takes the edge off the experience in that regard, it will maybe have to work harder to keep it interesting and to keep the sort of the feeling of change and motion present in the game, because even if you're not having the exact same game experience, having the exact same emotional experience, or at least a blunted emotional experience over and over again, is just something I'm not interested in.
Or is this a problem, really? All
these emotions, you just seem spoiled by them.
Well, it's the... Is it Blizzard's intent that these games be things that people play forever and ever and have a competitive scene? Haven't they explicitly said that Heroes of the Storm, they're not really fussed about having a competitive scene because it's more about...
I'm not really thinking in terms of a competitive scene, but when you, even when you play the alpha, they do start directing you towards the shop, and I spend money in Dota because I am that invested in the game and because it means a lot to me to have... a level of personalization, and I've invested in the heroes and in the world. Whereas in, you know, Heroes of the Storm, I don't necessarily know that I'll get to that point. You know, like, fine, I might splash out on this, you know, rainbow unicorn, but that'll be a one-off because it's funny purchase rather than I'm invested in these characters, invested in this world, I really want to, you know, spend all this time. And so given that they clearly want it to be monetizable, I would argue that that is a concern that they will have to bear in mind, regardless of a pro scene. You know, that might just be a thing that they don't have for that, or that it might come about in a different way.
Kind of disagree. Like, I think having a pro scene or a competitive side, like a high level professional side, is just proof of a multiplayer formula. It is simply, if a multiplayer formula is good enough, it will gain. It will be fun to watch. And if it's fun to watch, people, you know, sponsorship will emerge around it, people will set up tournaments and then pay to watch this tournament. Like, esports are not something that the vast majority of developers choose for their own games. Blizzard took way more control over StarCraft 2 than I think has been the case for a lot of others. But for most part, Brood War or Dota or League of Legends or anything, they're, you know, the developers do their bit, the international or Riot stuff, but then the community does the rest, and that's not because they have to, it's because the formula is sufficiently interesting to enough people that they will pay to watch it at a high level.
And that's what happened with World of Tanks. The investment from the company came after the emotional investment and the interest from the community. It was kind of like the community proved the interest, and then the company, you know, obviously was then able to plough money into it and was, you know, built a team around developing it as an eSport, developing the proposition. And, you know, the thing is, it might well happen with Heroes of the Storm. It's more, like, just in answering your question, that was...
I was just wondering whether it was... you know, if a game is fun for 100 hours, like Hearthstone maybe has been for you, does it matter that it's not going to be fun for the next 900 hours? You've still got 100 hours of fun out of it. And similarly with the esports thing, you know, Horse is a good multiplayer game, and as much as I'd love for basketball to be a real thing, it's not actually a competitive sport that people go and play it. But then that's not a criticism of Horse, that it's not like a Premier League style.
I think it's weird, because like if you'd asked me this a year and a half ago, before I'd ploughed thousands of hours into Dota, like over 1,000 hours into Dota, like, it would have probably been inconceivable that I would spend more than 100 hours on one particular game, and so of course, you know. But I guess, you know, the perspective has shifted slightly for me, in that, you know, it has to sort of bear that in mind.
I think
it's there is a slight perspective shift.
That's the thing people expect from Blizzard, because they did Brood War and StarCraft 2 and kind of Dota, which were such big esports things. And so, and World of Warcraft obviously had this huge end game as well. And so when Diablo 3 comes out and doesn't last forever, then people get annoyed at them and critique their design for it. And I think a similar thing happens. Maybe.
Fuck you for making this finite.
Well, actually, I think that's an interesting point, because we are really used to measuring a game's sort of value in the amount of time it lasts you. And, I mean, yeah, I've played a lot of Dota, but that's not because I'm, you know, it's not because the game is long. You know what I mean? It's not because it's a 1400 hour long game. It's because it's part of my life now, right? Like, it is not, it's now a part of my lifestyle rather than, like, you know, a game I get X amount of hours enjoyment out of. Like, if something disastrous happened, like if there was some crazily bad balance patch, or for some reason I didn't want to play it anymore and it felt like I was done with it, then I wouldn't go, well, I've had my 1400 hours of enjoyment. That's enough. You know, I can't, you know, for the amount of money I've spent or for, you know, the amount it's given me, can't really fault it. I would be distraught because something that has become part of my daily routine has been taken away. And I think that's the difference. I think a lot of these games, I think, you know, this expectation is on Blizzard games, that they get adopted into people's daily lives in some way. I think it, you know, and it's true of this genre, or particularly, you know, people assume that they are commitments. And yeah, maybe it's reasonable to make a game in that genre that isn't, and maybe that's part of the offering. I don't think that's particularly well expressed. And also, I don't think it's a particularly good fit for the free-to-play model necessarily, where you're always kind of buying into a hobby, pretty much. You know what I mean? It's, everything is the first investment of, quote-unquote, many. You know what I mean? Like, you never buy the whole thing.
It's like collectible minerals and rocks magazine.
Yeah, like you are always going to be getting the new hero or whatever and committing, and that's what they want you to do. So to an extent, it does need to be good past 100 hours. Like it does need to have, and I think for me, it needs to have like self-sustaining diversity and interest. Like it can't simply rely on a developer coming along and you know, shaking everything up every now and then. Like it has to
Here's a new map, isn't it?
It has to be the sort of fundamental, interesting thing of being up against another person and not only seeing the character they play and why that's interesting, but also seeing them, what they do and don't know and can and can't do, and negotiating that little conflict. And where a multiplayer game stands off the edges and you lose that, that's when it starts to lose me.
Do you think that it will change if they introduce a drafting mode?
They're going to. I spoke to them about that. They will have ranked, and when they add ranked play, they're going to make some things a little bit different about how you get into games. It's not that they've got a plan, actually. I don't want to disparage it too much, but it's sort of the proof's in it, and it is an alpha game. I think they need to do a really good job of just demonstrating how that game is best played, because I don't think it's actually best played if you walk in trying to play it like Dota. Like, as I've always said, like, my experience of liking that game more has always been an experience of unlearning something that I know. And I guess what I was trying to say earlier by citing Dota's popularity, by saying that, like, that's not going to be an isolated problem, right? That's not something they have to treat as like a few people will come in with the wrong expectations. Potentially, you know, Dota's audience plus LoL's audience, you're looking at upwards of 50 million people minimum are going to come in with the wrong view, and they may be, both in terms of the longevity of the game perhaps and how you play it and how you get the best enjoyment out of it, and there needs to be quite a substantial effort to like correct the lens
expectations.
I'll
be interested to see how it develops for sure. Like I say, it was an enjoyable experience. I definitely had a fun time, and I was purposely not trying to treat it like Dota, because I kind of felt like that would just be bizarre and weird, and it would lead to the wrong kinds of things and not experiencing it for what it actually was, but for what it wasn't. Because, you know, if you're just sat there going, yeah, but why can't I buy items? You know, it would just be like, well, then why are you even playing this game? But yeah, so I will be interested in how it develops, and also in sort of whether the community takes to it and has that same sort of obsessive dissecting relationship and discussing relationship with it. So, yeah, that's why I was asking about the drafting, because its absence means that it takes away one of the many ways in which you can fail at a MOBA without even realising you've failed before you've even got into the game. But at the same time, it's a layer of complexity and interest. I mean, you know, we've spent ages, like, with talking about, like, okay, so why wouldn't you pick this thing? Or why wouldn't, you know, like, me asking questions. But, yeah, so that's part of the enjoyment and sort of part of the friction that you can get to grips with and actually sort of find a way into the game and it has an impact rather than it being this dulled experience, I guess.
Hmm. Shall we do questions?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jack Reynolds asks, you're all stuck on a desert island with your entire Steam library.
Shit.
Which game do you eat first?
Sorry, what?
I liked the twist the Steam on, library? Like, what is almost going to be an obvious question, and then isn't.
Can I just say, mine would be Dota, because it's got the most bites.
Bites?
Yeah, bites, maybe. Like, for installing and hard disk.
Megabytes.
You want, like,
I have
Crisis
to eat
3
it.
Is, like, 25
I know, but it's not even the most... The biggest game in the... I mean, like...
It's because I had a quick look on my Steam library on your computer, which limits me to knowing the sizes of games that you have installed that I have in my library.
Okay. That's a lot of effort to go to for that joke.
How big is it?
I know, and it didn't even work. You didn't even laugh. This is a problem with the audience.
It's because we all have games that are bigger than Dota 2. GTA is bigger than that.
Max Payne 3 is bigger than that.
Which is bigger than that.
Well, we need to work Skyrim on our probably. Steam library parity then.
I would probably eat something like Osmos or Waves. Maybe Waves. Or Shatter. Or like any of those like arcade games that look like sweets.
Space Giraffe.
Yeah, like, or Dyad. I'd eat Dyad.
I'd eat Fract, although I don't have it yet.
Like, yeah, that doesn't look healthy. It doesn't look healthy, but it does look tasty.
I mean, if we wanted to draw a meaningful question from that, is there anything that you've uninstalled because you knew it wasn't healthy for you to play it any longer? Oh, like, wow. I sometimes... At this, my favourite list on Steam now is stuff that I feel like I ought to play. It's not my favourite games. All my favourite games are kicked out of that list. It's only things that I haven't played yet, and I know I kind of should, because everyone keeps saying it's good. And then, of those, every now and then I just think, like, I play that one now, and it's, like, maybe it's compulsive, but I'm not getting anything beneficial from it, so I'm just going to, like, take it out of the favourites list and uninstall it. And...
This is kind of like what Football Manager 2014, where I keep getting all these games that I really want to play. They sound really interesting. This past weekend, it was The Last Federation, which is the new Arson games. The AI War. Mm-hmm. Sounds really fascinating. But then I just play Football Manager 2014 all weekend instead. And a lot of it is like, Football Manager feels like productivity in a way, because it is like...
Football managing.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a management
He's got
sim.
A job.
It feels like you're accomplishing things, but you're not actually accomplishing things. Mm. But no, I haven't uninstalled it because it's not good for me. I'm still in the purely, it's not good for me stage.
I actually uninstalled all of the, pre-installed Windows games because I couldn't be trusted.
Pre-installed
like,
Windows
seriously,
games?
Seriously, it's Minecraft. I mean, Minecraft
Jesus
is
Christ, really?
Minesweeper.
Historic deal.
Minesweeper and, no, Spider Solitaire was what really pushed it over the edge. I cannot have that on my computer. I can't do it because otherwise I just, you'll find me just like, you know, 5 days later, haven't eaten, haven't left the house, haven't done any work, you know, just one more go. I'll
Got
do it.
It
this time, and I just can't have it on my PC.
If Windows did come with Minecraft, then that would be amazing.
It will eventually, won't it? I mean, come on, it's
that
only
was,
a matter of time.
I mean, speaking of Doom and the kind of the effect that it had, I remember, I think Gabe Newell tells the anecdote of when he was at Microsoft and they were charged with kind of going around and just surveying people's PCs and finding out what they had installed. And they found there was only one program in the world that more people had installed than Windows, and it was Doom. Doom was more popular than Windows.
I guess, I think, like, in terms of, like, obviously this is the sort of traditional measures of bad for you, like, takes up all of your time and makes you angry at your friends.
I would say those are bad, yeah.
Yeah. But I think it might actually be Skyrim. Because, and I talked about this on the podcast before, like, I lose so much time to modding that game, and it interacts with my OCD in some interesting ways. Like, I like areas to be clean. I like tidiness most of the time. And I like my mods to be tidy. And mods are essentially untidy. in some way, right? That you are mixing and matching files that aren't supposed to be there. You are bolting things to a game that maybe was a bit broken and wonky in its vanilla state anyway. So I have to make the most stable, you know, 60 frames a second, good looking, balanced game I can with the mods that are available. And then when I've done that, I don't play it. Because I might discover a bug that would drive me around the bend. And I know how much time I might lose. Like, I might lose a weekend doing this. And then I know I might lose even more if I actually play it and then get two zones over and realize that all of the grass is like a blank blue box now.
See, this is something that I've actually started running into. Ever since you've showed me how to mod this damn thing, then it has just basically been me going, oh, I could fix that. I could fix that so hard. And then, like, if the right mod, I can't find it, then I'm like, well, clearly the whole game's unplayable now. And
you can make it yourself. So Morrowind, I had, like, when I played Morrowind for 100 hours or whatever, when I was supposed to be finishing my degree, I really loved it, and it was like a total revelation for me, but there was just a bunch of just really simple technical things that needed fixing about it. I knew this for sure, and in fact even Bethesda knew them by the end of by the time they came to make Oblivion, because they fixed all of them eventually. But things like your walking speed was insanely slow, absurdly, laughably slow. Magicka never regenerated unless you drank a potion. So if you wanted to be a spellcaster, well, you just can't. You just run out of magic, and then you either have to expensively drink potions or there was a bunch of like these little technical things that just needed fixing for the game to actually work. So I just went into the construction set, which comes with it, which is the actual tool they use to make the game, and I made a ring that does all of these things. Constantly regenerates Magicka, and I even made like my own formula for how it should regenerate Magicka faster when you're closer to your limit, so that if you expend masses at once, it would have a slower regen. It would increase your running speed, it would boost certain skills like if you were underpowered, it would increase your rate of improving other skills and all this other stuff. And it was just the fix the game ring, and I put it in a barrel in Seder Neen, which is the town where you start, and then every time I start a character, I walk up to that barrel, take the ring, put it on. Game is fixed.
That's yeah, awesome. There's that part of it.
See, I can't get the trees to look right, and I know that's a ridiculous problem.
It isn't.
But they won't move right in the wind, and it bothers me. And now that I know that there should, in theory, be a way to fix it, I can't look at it without it feeling wrong and broken.
How do you know there's wind?
Look.
There's the sound of wind, actually, yeah. So I can get to you. Because when you sit there and you're lying back in your chair with your eyes closed, your headphones on max, listening to a YouTube video to determine what ambient bird song noise you want.
Yes. Yes. And they do the comparisons. And you're yeah, like, why yeah. aren't you comparing the
this
exact
one's,
same
This
areas?
One's got a little bit more kind of like grass blowing in the background. And what if it's not in a grassy area? Like, I'm discordant in some way. And basically what you do is that you start something like, it is like this frustration of trying to make this thing perfect and then not playing it at all, and I lose so much time to it. Now I'm at a point where I have an install that's pretty good, and I'm just leaving it. Like, it's installed, but I have in the past multiple times totally uninstalled and deleted everything Skyrim related from my computer. Not just so I can start again, but because really, the only way to make it perfect is to kill it. Like, you know what I mean? This whole transfer.
The only good Skyrim is a dead Skyrim.
It's like, I have made you perfect, Skyrim. Sleep. Sleep. The water is perfectly reflective because it doesn't exist.
Oh, water is another problem for me, because for the mod that works that does the good water, I need to buy the expansions, and I can't really justify the expense right now, but it is bothering me sufficiently that it is a very real risk that I will just spend that money.
I still want to know about the trees thing. So the trees don't move at all in the wind, but you can hear wind.
They don't move right. Like, there are a few that where it sort of waves in a really, you know, like some,
they move but not in the right way.
Branches. Like, the leaves are arranged sort of like a plane, almost. And then, you know, there's a few of them and they kind of interact. And if you squint, perhaps it's passable. But it just isn't. It's not okay, Tom. It's just not okay.
Honestly, never noticed this.
So, well, you will forever now.
One of the things that's really interesting about going insane with Skyrim.
It's interesting about going insane.
Well, you gain this really enhanced sense of what the game is doing at all times. Like, I think the thing that really breaks, like, I played Skyrim for 120 hours without installing any mods on purpose because I knew this would happen. Because it happened with Oblivion and it happened with Morrowind.
That's why I should have stuck to the Xbox.
Yeah, it's why I didn't break it for myself for that long, because I wanted to play it. And in that time, you focus on what your character's doing and things around them, and you're not thinking about how the game is generating that illusion for you.
Yeah.
And I know Skyrim's engine well enough now that, like... And I know, you know, decent memory from what mods I've got installed and what I've installed recently. And I... The various different types of crash that happen when something's slightly wrong tell you pretty much what's happened. There's a very specific thing that happens if the game tries to pull an asset it can't find. And... I got to this point where I was like, you know, on a new character trying to play sincerely, and I rode over a hill into a new massive territory, and the game crashed. And I was like, I know exactly where that is. That's because I've installed a series of, like, NPC overhauls for a set of characters that are three towns away. And I've also installed a mod that means the town doors are open and it loads the interior cells of towns in the open world. So it's just tried to generate those characters for the first time. And I know that one of them uses an optional hair mesh that I haven't installed. And it's crashing because it's looking for some guy's hair 4 miles away. And so you're riding around on your horse, like, not thinking about what your character's thinking, but, like, sort of, like, the god's eye view.
That hair, man! Yeah. It's not gonna load!
Yeah. Like, there's missing hair a long, long way away. I bought the game, and then you go and fix that miles away. And so you're actually fixing the game, like, a couple of miles ahead of where you are.
Mm.
And then you find something slightly wrong about it anyway, like an entire one faction's shields had the purple texture missing texture. I was like, why the fuck is that? And it took me ages. And I had to, like, piece into, like, they get their shields from a particular forge, and I've changed the way that forge functions in the crafting system because of the material change I installed earlier. It's like, and that's why they're purple. And
you guys should be developers, so that you can get paid for doing this.
Or QA testers, at least.
Do you know what I've noticed, actually, was that ever since I started modding and titting about with it, I think of Skyrim in the same way I think of my doll's house. And that's, you know, like, it's no longer a game, it's a thing where I have a very specific sense of how it should feel. I don't necessarily have a sense of how it should look, like, it's not exactly prescriptive, but it has to feel right, it has to feel like mine. And every time I can't find quite the right asset, it jerks me out of that so badly. And yeah, like, I have a similar thing with the doll's house. Like, if I can't find the right thing, then, you know, it's impossible.
I think, I mean, the reason I brought it up is because I think this is about as close to a very specific type of unhealthy as I can find in my Steam library. Like, I think that attitude towards the game is endlessly engaging to me, but really unhealthy as a use of my time. Like, I think maybe it's, you know, I learned something from knowing how Skyrim's engine works to the extent that I do, but I don't really feel like, I know when I'm getting drawn into it, and it's like 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and I've been up early, and I've spent 3 hours on it already, and I know that I'm going to be late for work on Monday, because some guy's hair was missing. And it's like, this is not, you know, I would rather play 12 games of Dota, you know? That at least is a social experience.
I uninstalled, I mean, basically PopCap games, the ones I usually uninstall for health reasons, rather than I'm not bored of them, I just don't, I want to be bored of them, I want them to go away now, because I'm wasting too much time. I think Plants vs. Zombies, Plants vs. Zombies probably did ruin itself, I didn't want to play it anymore. Bejeweled 3, I still wanted to play, and I just thought, I regret the time I spend with this game, so I should just delete it and move on.
You were saying earlier that was it Haribo was pathological? Said when you had finished the bag, you weren't sad that you didn't have it anymore. You were happy.
Yeah, anytime you're eating something, if when it's completely finished and it's gone and you can't have any more, if the emotion you feel then is happiness, then your eating habit was pathological.
That's a really amazing link back to this question. Which was about which games you would eat.
We'd eat all the unhealthy things around us until they were gone.
If you're and glad then you're happy. You ate
Bejeweled 3. Yeah. And then we'd play something educational, maybe. Good for us.
Matthew Cox asks, when you're imprisoned for pun-based crimes against humanity, which video game character would you choose as a cellmate?
One that can break out of prisons?
Yeah.
Garrett?
Just like, any of the protagonists from
any
Elder Scrolls game.
Yeah. So, yeah, of course. They all break out from the start.
Emperor Septim.
Yeah, I go with Emperor Septim. I saw you in my dream.
But surely if you didn't see you in a Skyrim game, you'd have like a lockpick about your person. Just one.
Just one up your ass crack.
Just one.
I believe that's canon.
Yeah. The secret inventory, they call it.
I don't know. I
Glasgow inventory. Oh, Twinsen from the Little Big Adventure series. Every place in that world he can get arrested, there's a unique jail, and every jail has a unique way of breaking out of it from within the prison cell. So Twinsen can literally break his way out of any prison cell in that world.
Hmm.
So I would want him.
Maybe one of the robots from Portal, like the co-op robots, because
Atlas and what's it?
Peabody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you know, Portals, you know, whatever. Sorry. Throwing that one in.
I think I would choose something I could eat. In case they forgot to feed me.
The temporary solution at best. Yeah.
But you know, so you'd eat their leg first so that they didn't die. What? I don't know, right, so...
Because you can eat any person.
A commie.
Like, I'm just trying to think of, like, you know, there must be, like, a giant ham in a video game or something.
Is this because you cooked a ham for
one of the characters from Peter Pinata?
That ham was amazing. Chris,
Pip just wanted to talk about ham.
No, but what I'm saying is, if you had like a video game character that was also food, but you worked from the outside in, you could like have a little nibble and then they wouldn't die and they would either like regrow whatever you'd eaten or like it would keep
but
for
you
a
have
while.
To know which character
like,
this is, Pip.
It
you
wouldn't go on.
Hypothetically.
Well, hang on. Okay, fine. Think of a video game character that is also a food. Because I'm struggling right now.
There must be
Viva Pinata.
Mm. Yes.
Well, they're full
but
of food.
But you have to kill them. You have to smash them open. And then you stuff your
That's
face.
What they want, though.
They just smash a small hole. And
no, you know what I would do? I
just
dehumanize
the pinata.
I would want to be in prison with two Newtgats from Viva Pinata. Because then you could start a breeding program and just kill their children.
The humane option.
Obviously, if I'm actually getting fed in prison, this is less of a... This would just be, like, an optional
a little bit cruel.
Also, if you just picked a character that helped you escape, you would be able to feed yourself.
But it might be comfy. Like, maybe I've done something shit. Maybe people are after me. You know, you haven't established why I'm in prison.
Pun crimes against humanity.
Oh.
That was established.
Oh, Twitter might be after me. That's no fun.
Matthew writes to ask, "Hello, Creighton Crowbar. I live in the US and recently discovered the BBC Sherlock Holmes series, which inspired me to not only start reading the original stories, but to start trying out some detective games. My problem is that the games I've found, including the Sherlock Holmes games, don't make me feel like an amazing detective. It makes me feel more like a clerk in some exercise in endless monotony. Are there any games that you know of that are really interesting detective games?"
Where's an egg?
Matthew. Oh. Where's an egg is a good answer. Also, we gave another
good
answer.
Yep, I think we covered one pretty in-depth. Somebody was telling me, I think it might have been about the Wadget Eye games.
Oh,
they were saying that
Blackwell.
Yeah, maybe. That there's a series where you are investigating crimes and stuff, and you're trying to solve them, and in order to solve them, you have to kind of use the pieces of information you have in your notebook on each other, the same way that you'd combine inventory items. So you say, use the fact that this person was at this location with the fact that at that location the murder took place, and then that produces this extra fact that, this person must have done the murder. And they were saying, like, it wasn't sort of a perfectly emergent system where you were genuinely, you know, creating a solution for yourself, but it gave you that feeling of, I solved it! I used clever things together. If it wasn't that, I will find out and we'll put it in the show notes.
Could it have been the Shiva? Which
maybe.
Is also, I think, you're a rabbi, but you are kind of investigating the mystery in that. It does have
rabbi
an interesting
cop.
System. Yeah. You can choose to give a rabbinical response to most things that people say.
Is that like a Mass Effect trigger pull?
I think of it like...
Rabbinical intervention.
The Father Ted thing where they teach Father Jack to say that would be an ecumenical
They should totally be a Father Ted RPG.
It should be a detective.
I was telling Marsh how I thought that there should be a massively multiplayer murder investigation game, and he thought that it should be called Massively Midsummer, which I think I can really get behind that. But, like, you know, if you just had
one this, massive yeah, drawing room,
if you just had like a county in England, like a fictional county in England where like very middle class people do very awful middle class crimes to each other,
that'd be amazing. Like Midsummer Eve.
Well, you could have two factions, right? You could have murderers and detectives.
Yeah, exactly.
You would, the murderers actually have to figure out the perfect murder and try and figure out this way to get away with it without leaving a trail of evidence to them, and then the detectives have to figure them out.
See, I think that this could work. I think this could be perfect.
And it would be, like, the murders would be so dense that, like, in trying to solve the murder that you want to solve, you'd end up solving someone else's murder because, like, some noob has just blundered in and shot, like, six guys in a drawing room. And so, I'm investigating this one murder, but actually, I can't ignore the fact that there are six corpses here and there's a guy just standing there with a smoking gun, like, laughing about it.
I don't know, like, yeah, the games that I've enjoyed the most in the sort of detective-y genre, I guess, are the ones that sort of let me feel more like I'm getting the same experience that I get from daytime murder mysteries. So things like Phoenix Wright, there's a certain amount of, you know, like, Dick Van Dyke in Diagnosis Murder, kind of. It's that sort of same kind of, like, clues and deduction, but with a sort of slight...
I think Wes and Egg is genuinely really good. partly because it's like, it's random. It's not the same culprit every time. And so when you are figuring it out, you are genuinely trying to read the mechanics and make logical deductions rather than trying to guess what the writer thought was the logical thing to happen. Which means it transcends all the stuff that you see in procedural detective shows when you watch them, where it's like, well, it's not going to be that person because it looks like it would be that person. Mm. Therefore, it can't be. Or that person I've seen in another show. So it was definitely them.
Yeah.
That thing of being 20 minutes through an episode where they accuse someone and you go, well, it's not them. Because then the episode would just have to end in 2 minutes' time when there's 20 minutes left.
Mm. You could make a competitive Columbo game where you'd have like a kind of, I guess, some sort of information delivery attack system, and the winner was the player who added one last thing last. So it's two people just both walking towards different doors and then spinning around, and then the first person to go through the door loses. Every time you say something, you move closer to a door.
Jack Reynolds asks, greetings, packages, and swagger shafts.
How do they say?
I've been pretty busy recently and haven't had much time to listen to any podcasts, but as I'm on holiday, I ended up listening to all of the new CNCs in the newest episode at the point where Kim Richards started ranting about bees in Minecraft. I immediately started laughing in a very crowded gym. What is the most inappropriate time or place that you've started laughing?
Me and a friend were in a shopping centre when some parents and their like 6 or 7 year old child were ahead of us, and the 6 or 7 year old child had a helium balloon in their hand, and they accidentally let go of it, and then the helium balloon raised to the ceiling out of their reach, and the child burst into tears, and me and my friend both burst out laughing at the exact same time and realized we are exactly as bad a person as each other. It was really funny. It was like, if I tried not to laugh, I couldn't have done it. It was just, like, tragicomic.
You're a monster. Although, mine was, I laughed at my grandmother's funeral because the priest got her name wrong.
Oh, no!
And, like, I just had that moment of, who the hell are we cremating? It was just like... Oh, maybe I shouldn't laugh. And then, you know, the more you try and not... the giggle loop from coupling, that kind of happened. And I was just, like, absolutely killing myself trying not to laugh at my dead grandmother's cremation.
I got my most last many public speaking at my grandmother's funeral.
Oh, really? Yeah. Did you tell knock-knock jokes or something?
It was the closest I've done to stand-up comedy. It was just funny things about my grandma.
That's awesome, though. That's kind of, like, heartfelt.
I guess I've never laughed at a funeral or anything. I guess all of my,
Bare Naked Ladies lyrics there, isn't there?
I think all of my, like, laughing at the wrong time disasters are kind of stage-related, inevitably, given what I used to do.
Failed actor, Chris.
Failed actor. That was a guy on the internet who didn't like my Elder Scrolls Online review. Went to the, and I'm so flattered that he went to the extent of Googling me. Googled me
to find found, I think, my old acting profile or something. I'm still on a few casting websites. And assume from that that I'm a failed actor, whereas I like to think of myself as no longer an actor. it sticks, it's fine. But use this as the basis for Word, given the game, the score I did, etc., rather than just simply having played it and not liked it. And it is the most amazing thing. Anyway, corpsing on stage is something that happens, and obviously it's not always in and of itself funny. Like, you know, the kind of simply having, getting the giggles at the wrong time.
The corpsing is when you
lose it to the extent that where it becomes self-sustaining and you just can't not laugh. You know, you learn ways of, like, there are breathing things you can do to stop yourself from laughing, for example. Normally, though, like, in comedy, it's not so much of a problem, and in theatre, it never...
It's funny how, like, killing, dying, and corpsing are all separate things in stage performance.
Yeah, yeah. The only one that's really got me, I think, at the worst possible time was in a performance of The Tempest, where I was playing Stefano, who's, like, this drunk who plots against Prospero, who's the wizard that lives on the island. And then at the end, he doesn't really have like a bad ending to his plot. He just finds out what he's trying to do is completely pointless, and it's never going to work. And he just sort of gives up when he realizes that the king's still alive and all the rest of the stuff happened. But the particular thing involved me having to walk backwards through a door, while sort of making a speech to two people that I was trying to lead into a deadly coup, and then spin around and be smack bang confronted with Prospero. And it's very hard to do that blocking so that it's exact, you know, the distance is exact. And it was fine if I span around and saw him and we were a few steps away from each other. And if it was fine if I span around and bumped into him, because the effect exactly worked. But my friend who was playing Prospero was quite significantly taller than me, and one show I span around and he span around at exactly the right distance, with him craning down to look and me looking up, that we pretty much kissed. It was totally unintentional, and it was a complete fluke of positioning. But there was really no coming back from it, because like neither of us could then go like so we both just laughed. So I was laughing. It was it was really hard to turn around, but yeah. So yeah. That's probably the worst time I've ever laughed.
JR asks, "Dear drinking away the pain of internet comments, I've been watching Tom Francis play Ass Creek 4 the last few days. Admittedly, because without Rich and Marsh to watch, I'm running out of erudite British games journalists playing games and getting drunk." It's occurred to me, though, that despite having no choice at all for huge swaths of that game, I still had lots of fun with its repetitive boarding action, and weirdly made me feel a lot more free to choose how I wanted to play minute to minute than I normally do in games. So first, is there anything you would recommend that gives the same sense of open world exploration on the open ocean? I'm likely the only human alive that liked every second of the Wind Waker sailing mechanic. And second, how much is choice in games reflective of how much freedom you have to play the game the way you want? All the best, JR.
How much is choice reflective of
choice?
How much freedom you have to play the game you want. So I guess, like, he's talking about the difference between minute-to-minute choice and, like, explicit, maybe, moral decisions in games or branching narratives or...
I guess, like, choice and getting my own way aren't one and the same. Like, if that's where the questions leading?
Let's skip that question. Stick to the first one. Are there any other games that have an open world exploration on the open ocean?
I remember the Tortuga games. I can't remember how many there have been now, but I think the one I played was at least two or three. And I was playing it because I was disc editor at the time, so I had to play every demo, and there was a demo that was on there. And it was a top-down thing about being... I don't know if you were strictly a pirate. You were in control of a ship, at least, and you went to different ports around the Caribbean, and you could trade with them, and you could negotiate with them, and some of them were your enemies, some of them were your allies. And it was really, really beautiful, and just, like, quite relaxing and nice, and, yeah, you just got to sail around the open seas and do that kind of business.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Lewis Roberts asks, "Dear Wooden Box and Iron Lever, preamble, what play..." This is actually what he's written. I'm not being a dick. For the first time ever. What place do you think games will have in society in, say, 5 or 10 years? Your humble Hibernian listener. Hibernian. But I didn't know where that word was going until I said it. It's pronounced Hibernian.
Good job, Graham. Keep on trucking.
It needs more preamble.
I think they will be more popular. It is already at the stage where, like, everyone basically plays games in the sort of the privileged world of people who can afford devices on which you can play digital games. And we haven't yet reached that point where, like, all the people who actually rule our society are, like, 50 to 60. And so they don't yet. And we are going to hit a point where they do. And that's going to be interesting. But yeah, it's going to lose a lot of the stigma for sure. And what's interesting to figure out is, like, what kind of games are going to be playing? Because the thing that's rising at the moment most is mobile. But I still don't really, when I think about what it's going to be like in like 20 years, I don't see everyone just playing games on mobile phones. That doesn't seem like what's going to happen. It seems like such a subpar experience, basically. It's like, yes, if you can't get to any other device, then this is, I guess, as good as it's going to get. But it feels like that is just a temporary compromise that we're making. And I mean, I guess, like, things you wear on your face are probably going to get better. I mean, like, virtual reality... Virtual reality and augmented reality are both kind of getting better at the moment, and probably those two are going to cross over at some point, where, like, a pair of glasses you can wear that actually let you continue to see the real world can also show you some really amazing visuals. Possibly, you know, they could be like contact lenses rather than actual a thing you have to wear on your face that's visible.
There's some really cool stuff that some research departments are doing as well. Like, I think Disney is doing some really cool stuff with touchscreen displays, like different, I think it's electromagnetic frequencies. Like, if you run your hand over something, it can actually give the illusion of texture or volume and depth.
Oh, right, so you can respond to it.
Because of how it stimulates your fingertips and things like that. So I think things like that could have an effect if they end up, you know, sort of as part of mainstream devices or as being able to be implemented, like, maybe in the, I don't know, 3 generations of iPads time or something. Yeah.
That wearing really magic goggles that let you pet a dog that isn't there.
Yeah.
Not specific.
That would be pretty boss.
There's something quite interesting about what we're discovering about motion control and motion tracking and that kind of thing, that, and every other control method, that the mouse still hasn't really been surpassed. Like, the mouse is just really fucking good. Like, I make games, and I can make games for whatever control method I like, and I make them specifically for the mouse, because the mouse, there's just nothing that's faster and more precise. Those two things are just, it's never been beaten on both those counts. And motion tracking, I guess you can be faster with it, and it's definitely more expressive and more natural, but there's still a lack of precision there. And gamepads and all that stuff is, like, you can get really good with them, but they're still never as fast and as precise as a mouse. And even if I have perfect tracking of my finger in 3D space and I can just move it wherever I want and it will be exactly represented in the game world, I actually can't move my finger as precisely in free space as I can when I have a flat surface to press it against, because there is an amount of friction and an amount of weight to that that actually stabilizes my movement to make sure that when I want to stay still, I do stay perfectly still, and when I want to move, I move. And I can't do that in free space. I need something against which to interface, I guess. So I think there's, like, the sort of bold future of future vision of interaction. It always does away with the computer and the controller, and it's always just we have gloves and we have contact lenses and stuff. I don't know, the contact lenses thing will probably happen, but we might still need some physical object to interact with, and it might not look like a mouse pad, but it might be just a physical thing that offers us some resistance so that our natural inaccuracies are not conveyed perfectly.
Well, I guess on the flip side of that, I think, was it you I was talking to about this before, Graham, about Oculus Rift and how I think that it will, you know, given that it seems to be taking off massively and has that sort of sustained interest and people have finally sort of been developing games for a virtual reality device, the idea of needing to control that using something you cannot see and can't use that same feedback, I think that might actually end up forcing the development of more accessible, perhaps, technology, because it has to be something that you, or input technology rather, because it has to be stuff that you can use your hands to do when you can't actually see the input. And so that might actually make it more accessible to, perhaps older people who just, you know, didn't get to grips with mouse and keyboard when that was, you know, making most sense to me, I guess. And you know, it might just actually serve to open up gaming in a different way, which could be really interesting. I was also thinking that maybe in 5 or 10 years there would be a lot more of the games that we write a lot about in terms of, you know, like Minecraft and Kerbal and stuff, as having educational impact and being actually able to be used by schools to teach a massive variety of complex ideas. You know, I think that that's just a thing that will carry on happening and will gradually sort of get more and more embedded into, you know, rather than just having a very specifically designed, very dorky, it is a school program, you know, it's like, no, actually, this is pretty damn cool, but you can also use it for schools to teach actual physics or, you know, particular types of programming or, you know, things like that. I think that could be a fascinating thing, and I think it's only going to get more prevalent.
The cartoonist Randall Munroe, who does the comic XKCD, did a comic recently about graphing his knowledge of orbital physics over time, from like learning high school physics to learning high school. And then he worked at NASA for a number of years, and his knowledge of orbital physics went up during that, but then like after he started playing Kerbal Space Program, skyrocketed, like way beyond what he learned at NASA.
I think Kerbal Space Program does a better job than any film or book or TV show about space travel of just conveying how hard it is. Because you watch Apollo 13 and it's a story about success, and you watch From the Earth to the Moon and it's a story of success, whereas Kerbal Space Program is just 99% the story of your failure. It's you blowing up and screwing everything up. It really does a great job of just conveying the impossible scale and making it awesome in the literal sense of the word. Zach writes, "Dear Critter Mandelson and Crony Blair."
Oh no!
Satire question mark. Right afterwards.
Slightly outdated.
Yeah. Update the podcast. It's fine.
Crony Blair was in the news today. I once read the novelization of Assassin's Creed 2 as a dare.
It would take a dare.
Most noticeably, its adherence to the game's progression mechanics was breathtaking. Every few chapters, Ezio would receive his new gadget, learn a new move, etc. Note, this book was not a spin-off of the game like the Halo books. It was a direct novelization of the game. Just imagine that for a moment. Needless to say, it was a hugely dispiriting task and stands out as the most banal event in the series of banal events that comprised my time at university. Anyway, hacks that you are, what video game novelization would you most like to write? Maybe give us a sentence or so as a little taster. Cheers, Zach.
I guess we talked a bit about this last week, but Mirror's Edge, I was like, I wanted the story, I had ideas for what the story for that should have been, and I, like, they weren't really enacted in the game, but the world was so evocative in that, that I love this idea of this, like, it's kind of a dystopia, but it's beautifully clean and like dazzlingly freshly painted and just incredibly exciting in ways that aren't
beautiful
important.
IKEA dystopia.
Yeah. And so, yeah, what's going on in that world is really interesting to me.
That was going to be my answer as well. I really love that world. It was such a great time just visiting that as a place. And I think there are interesting stories kind of hinted at throughout it and the way that world functions.
And also it's like, I mean, it's quite well suited to a novelization in that it's not a game about shooting a bunch of dudes necessarily. I mean, you actually do end up doing that. Mm. But it doesn't have to be, and that's not what the themes are about, and that's not kind of what the story is. So it wouldn't have to be. And then Faith walked into this room and shot 12 guys, but then in the next room shot 14 guys.
It's the Doom novelization, which actually is just that. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Just, and then he shot a Kekko demon, and then he, you know, and so on and so on.
I'm trying to think. There's a couple I'd like to do.
Surely you must want to write something BioWare-shaped.
I was going to say Mass Effect. Not because, I mean, I've read all the Mass Effect novels, obviously. But they are like side stories. Like he says, they are not like direct accounts of those games. It would be amazing to write the
Mass Effect novelization, because it'd be like, you know, Commander Shepard stood on the bridge of the Normandy. He or she turned to Joker and said, "How far out are we?" Which is the first line of Mass Effect 1. And Joker Joker replied, "Something, a number of clicks," and Commander Shepard either replied, "Great," or, "You're an asshole." At which point, Joker was either pleased or just sad. Or sad.
Would you be tempted to work it into a choose your own adventure novel?
No, not at all. He'll spoil it. Then you're just making the game. Like, right. No, it has to be, and it has to be like.
And then, if in the earlier scene Joker had said he was sad, then what would here happen?
Because I was just trying to think how those bits would work.
Commander Shepard stood in front of the mission terminal button that was ticking down to zero and tried to figure out how to save both people, realized that they probably couldn't, and decided to stand there for 3 hours. Figuring out who to choose. He thought, "Do I like Ashley?" He or she thought. "Or do I really like Caden? Which one of them is probably a romance option?"
Never Caden. Ever.
Caden's alright.
He's a twat.
Kill Caden.
Yep.
That's what I did. And then after that, like, they just assume that you would have been massively conflicted about decisions. So there's always the option to say, "Oh, I just miss Caden so much, and I'm just so proud of that Caden." And everyone's like, "Nope, let's just get on with business, please. Move as quickly along."
And his character-defining headaches.
Glad to have you here, Ashley.
It was the bane of my life when he just kept popping back up. I was like, "Oh, for God, will you just not go away?"
I think Caden suffered, right? Caden suffers, because in the novelization it would be like,
damn right, he should.
Shepard met Caden Alenko, the second in command on the Normandy, and realized, "You really do sound like Carthanasi from Knights of the Old Republic. Are you played by Raphael Sabaj?" Commander Shepard checked IMDb and found out that yes, indeed he is. And he's almost in every way exactly the same character. Because of him feeling redundant for being almost exactly the character in two different bio-RPGs, Commander Shepard strapped him to a nuke. The other one I'd write would be Dota. "Fuck you, Dazzle," said Pudge.
Wow.
"Where the fuck are the wards, you asshole?"
Oh, that reminds me, I haven't looked up Dota fanfiction in a while.
It almost certainly exists.
Oh no, I mean it does, but I mean I just haven't looked at it for a while. Do you remember I shared that
I basically write it every
Counter-Strike fanfiction at some point? That was an interesting one. It's, you know, like, obviously it's star-crossed lovers, like the terrorists fall in love with the counter-terrorists. Like,
obviously.
Sonic the Hedgehog is there.
I'll reshare it, it's fine.
We should link to, is it available, man? Owen's.
Story.
Yeah, CS Story, that's great.
Which is the story.
Not quite a text adventure, but like a Twine adventure.
It's a Twine game.
And it's a story not set within the Counter-Strike universe, but trying to make the decisions about whether to play Counter-Strike or uninstall it.
When your friends are about to come over for the night and you only got a certain amount of time to play, and if your game doesn't go well, it might affect your mood for the rest of the evening, and that can have long-term effects on your life.
Yeah.
It's the Being Owen simulator, for sure.
It's such a good game. I think, for me, what I'd really like to write a novelization of it. You know how Agatha Christie novels, the Poirot novels, tend to get adapted for hidden object adventures?
Mm.
I'd like to re-novelize them, but try and integrate the fact that Poirot's looking for three butterflies in a cabin. You know, like somehow make that work. Somehow make that make sense in the Agatha Christie verse. You know, like when he's just like, "Well, there is a corpse. However, I'm just going to find 15 ribbons and then I will be right with you." So yeah, I think that would be an interesting challenge.
Like the Pride and Prejudice and Zombies kind of equivalent of... That would be cool.
But yeah, or you could do like the novelization of the video game of the Lego Movie.
Could you do like a Tom Clancy novel about Counter-Strike? It's like 5 minutes of terror or something.
I still love the Ubisoft.
Up to 90 minutes of terror, maybe.
Ubisoft, but that's like 15 rounds.
Yeah, it's like full comp.
Ubisoft have a guy whose job title is Chief Clancy Writer, which I still love.
Your main job is to be the key, the most important writer of this person's works. Not him, but you know, just the most important person who writes the things that are attributed to him.
He could be Tom Clancy's Tom Clancy.
Oh boy.
That's all the time we have for questions, because that's all the questions we have.
If you'd like to send us a question on the internet, you can do so by emailing questions@creightandcrowbar.com or by tweeting at Creighton Crowbar, or by visiting our forum, which you should do anyway, creightoncrowbar.com/forum, and leaving a question in the questions forum. And I can't say the words questions or forum anymore because I've used them all up forever. If you'd like to ask us a thing you'd like to know on Twitter directly to people like us,
you can do that.
Then you can find us as individuals on Twitter. I'm at C Thurston, that's CTHURSTEN. That's also what you should Google if you'd like to find out about failed actors in your area. Graham.
At Gonnas, GONNAS.
Tom. At Pentadact, PENTADACT.
And I'm at Philippa War, which is PHILIPPAWAWR. Yes!
A lot of doubles.
My parents hated me.
Thanks for listening, everybody!